Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Museum of Science. The Heart of New England, their new giant screen production, is narrated by Uzo Aduba and Mindy Kaling. You can see it now in the Mugar Omni Theater. Tickets and more information at mos.org. And M&M Skylights, installing and servicing a wide range of commercial and residential Velux skylight products. You can find more information about their installation process and schedule a consultation at mmskylights.com.
Today on BPR Live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library on Wednesday, comedian and actor Kevin Hart was tapped to take charge of next year's Oscars until a history of homophobic tweets was unearthed. Hart says he shouldn't be held accountable for who he was 10 years ago, particularly because he's already apologized. The Academy thinks otherwise. We'll open the lines and ask you, at what point in the court of public opinion do we get to vacate our sins?
The story of real-life champion prizefighter Emil Griffith, whose struggles, demons, and downward spiral into dementia is the subject of the play Man in the Ring. We talked to the lead actor and Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright about the story of an immigrant, a story of a bisexual man making his way in the most brutal sport, and how a truly fatal blow in the ring changed everything. Then at noon, hours before her 20th anniversary celebration at Beat the Press, Emily Rooney is here with her famous list of complaints. All that next on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Friday, and every Friday we broadcast live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Hey, Jim.
Speaking of live, tonight at 7 o'clock, Emily Rooney is going to be doing a live 20th anniversary version of Beat the Press.
I'm
excited. Can't wait, actually. She'll be with us at noon. But first, after Kevin Hart announced that he would host next year's Oscars, Jimmy Kimmel tweeted, "The Academy made an excellent choice. Chris Rock joined in. They got the best person for the job." The Hollywood Reporter wrote that Hart is, quote, "funny without being tasteless." That was before the backlash. Didn't take long for Kevin Hart to be in trouble over homophobic tweets and comments, most of them years old. In a stab at damage control, the Academy reportedly gave Hart an ultimatum, apologize or don't host. Hart posted his response on Instagram. Here's part of it. "I've decided to pass. I pass on the apology." Oh, here it is. I'm sorry.
"I chose to pass. I passed on the apology. The reason why I passed is because I've addressed this several times. This is not the first time this has come up. I've addressed it. I've spoken on it. I've said where the rights and wrongs were. I've said who I am now versus who I was then. I've done it. I'm not going to continue to go back and tap into the days of old when I moved on."
Actually, about an hour later, he did tap into the days of old when he tweeted, I'm assuming after his agent said, "I don't think that's going to work, Kevin." He said, "I sincerely apologize to the LGBTQ community for my insensitive words from my past. Most people think it's not enough. I'm amongst them." He moved on, so should we. Our number is 877-301-8970. Hart says these homophobic jokes and tweets were nearly 10 years old, which is true. He's apologized, and the court of public opinion, should his crimes be vacated or not? And we want to discuss the larger thing. I'd say every 6 months. Well, actually, it wasn't even 6 months ago. We talked about in the case of Judge, or now Justice, Kavanaugh. When you've done something inappropriate or worse, when do you get forgiven for your sins? Or I guess to put it in another way, when does an apology sort of do the trick? I think Kevin Hart's comment on Instagram, which was succeeded by this half-hearted apology, pretty much doesn't do the trick. But when does it work? Our number is 877-301-8970. Can I give you an example where it doesn't work?
Where?
When you tweet an apology for sexual misconduct and you attach to the apology a recipe for a cinnamon roll, which is what Mario Batali did. That doesn't work. And by the way, we're not talking today about the Harvey Weinsteins of the world. I mean, when he does 20 years in jail, when he gets out, we can talk about him giving us a heartfelt apology. We're talking about sins of a lesser magnitude, which is not to suggest that homophobic comments are not painful at all. It's just to suggest we don't want to talk about the real evildoers, the Les Moonveses at the moment, or the Harvey Weinsteins. We want to talk about Kevin Hart kinds of misbehavior. And, you know, my view, I'm a huge, you know, we've talked about this maybe 100 times mm-hmm. in the years that we've been on the radio. You know what everybody says? An apology has to be of a certain quality. And the critical ingredient in all I've read through the years is that it has to show empathy for those who have been hurt.
Right.
Real empathy and focus recognition of it.
On them,
and
not
this,
you.
Exactly. And this it doesn't do anything. It's sort of like, you know, the great Potter Stewart line, I can't define obscenity, but I know it when I see it. Well, I sort of know when an apology is legit when I hear it, and this is not one.
On the other hand, you do want people to be able to grow. And I think
I agree with that, of course,
obviously. He said a really stupid thing about his son back in 2011. This is Kevin Hart. Yo, if my son comes home and tries to play with my daughter's dollhouse, I'm going to break it over his head and say, stop, that's gay. That was in 2011. But he said that he was wrong and that he's grown and learned. And I think there's an awful lot of people who were opposed to gay marriage until it became, or even after it became, the law of the land in Massachusetts and then the law of the land nationwide. So I think you don't want to say to people that you can't
evolve out
yes.
of your... Yeah, but again, we played the Instagram thing a minute ago. It was pretty clear there was no contrition until he had contrition. It was all sort of like, and aren't you convinced that what I said is true? He did the Instagram thing on his own.
Yeah.
And then his agent calls him on the phone and obviously says, that's not going to cut it, Kevin. If you want to stay on the, or maybe the people from the Academy Awards said, that's not going to cut it. And he does a half-hearted apology kind of thing. Apologies are a real important part of life because everybody, including the two of us, obviously have screwed up big time. But there's a certain level of sincerity and, as I said, empathy that's got to be part of it that just isn't here. So we want to talk to you about it. We want to talk about it in the context of Kevin Hart. That's fine. If you want to talk about it in a broader context, when you should be forgiven for your sins and what kind of an apology gets you there. If you want to give us some examples of what you think has worked and what you think is not, we're happy to hear those at 877-301-8970.
Well, you know which one I always love
in
the 12 steps? They say that you've got to make amends. So if you screwed somebody or you did something or you stole something or you hurt your member of a family or spouse, whatever, you've got to figure out how to make amends to that person. That's a really big one. But getting in the story, the stories about apologies, people are taking a lot of heat, are, of course, Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, because they seem not to be insincere in their multiple apologies for everything that was going wrong at Facebook.
Well, I would argue far worse than that. Laura Ingraham, who we used to work with, her pathetic non-apology to David Hogg and the survivors of the Parkland shooting was pathetic and clearly did not. You know who actually did a good job? I was making some notes. Elliot Spitzer. I'm not a huge fan of him. Remember, mm-hmm. he was like a crusading attorney general and governor. Here's Elliot Spitzer. This is after, remember, he has sex with this woman with knee-length black socks on, which is what the image we can't. He says, I've acted in a way that violates my obligation to my family, he goes on to say, and that violates my or any sense of right and wrong. I apologize first and most importantly to my family. I apologize to the public whom I promised better. I'm not saying his family should forgive him. That's their business. I'm saying as a member of the public, that's the kind of thing you got to say that clearly was absent from the Hart thing. I have to say, the reason I'm obsessed with this and we do it so much, I don't know how you feel, I think apologies and whether you forgive somebody for their sins is one of the single most important things one does in life, because we're all crossing the line all the time. Hopefully not in horrible ways, but in ways that hurt other people. And so this whole thing about apologies is a big deal.
We've talked a lot about that in terms of hospitals and care. We had the young man in
Peter DeMarco
who lost his wife. And he was basically getting stonewalled and stonewalled and stonewalled by the hospital over in Somerville until he wrote that piece in the Globe. And then they sort of had a public apology kind of thing. We talk about this with Art Kaplan all the time, how when physicians make mistakes, you know, people wouldn't sue as much if the physician apologized. And then it was the classic case. We've talked about this a million times. But why not say it one more? Excuse me, I have a cold. That's why I sound bad. The then president of MIT, a young man, drank himself to death at a fraternity party. And the kid, you know, apparently had never had much to drink, and he guzzled an entire fifth of vodka. And
it was a fraternity thing, was it?
It was a fraternity. It was a fraternity hazing or admission ceremony, whatever. The kid was a freshman, he was 18 years old. And the president of MIT drove to the parents' house, wherever they lived, to apologize for what happened to their son.
His name was Scott Kruger, was the
name
of the young man. I just looked it up.
You know, your lawyers will tell you, never do this, never do this, never do this. But many people have ignored those lawyers and gone ahead and done it anyway. And the irony is that sometimes that apology takes away the offended person's enthusiasm for a lawsuit.
Well, you know, I hope I'm right about this, and if not, one of our producers, our coworkers. I think this is a pathetic state of affairs, but it's the state of the world in 2018. Haven't some states, didn't we discuss this with Art Kaplan, actually passed laws that says a health professional, a doctor's apology, cannot be used in a malpractice case, meaning that it takes away the disincentive to apologize. I mean, one should apologize if you did wrong, even if there's going to be a consequence for the apology, but apparently there's some statutory protection. In any case, if you want to talk about the Kevin Hart thing, that's fine. We want to talk a little broader, but it is up to you. 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Jane in Natick. Hi, Jane.
Hey, Jane.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my phone call.
Sure.
Thanks for calling.
You know what popped into my head when you were just talking about this was Mark Wahlberg, you know, mm-hmm. asking to get pardon for his felony assault conviction, you know, for he attacked a Vietnamese
yep.
man. And then wasn't he always doing this little gang stuff when he was young? Well,
yeah, he was a pretty tough young guy. Wasn't he attempting to get something? Was there something that he was trying to achieve? It was a couple of years ago when he was doing that apology.
Yeah,
wasn't there an end game there?
He wanted to be pardoned, but I don't think they did. He wanted to be pardoned, you know, to overturn that, or just to pardon his felon, to erase his felony. But I don't think that's right. It should remain in public. It should remain in records.
Well, you know what right. There was an agenda there, and thank you very much for your call, Jane. You know, I was thinking about another way you can tell, at least in my estimation, whether an apology is sincere, is timing. You know that in so many of these apologies, what they're really saying is, I'm sorry I got caught.
Right.
And so doing it before you're on the spot, the timing also is a huge part of this, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, they also talk about the fact that, as I said before, that you've got to be, you've got to think about the other person's needs.
Sure.
So it probably wasn't that effective when Arnold Schwarzenegger, who had a baby with his housekeeper, said, I apologize to Maria, I apologize to my family, end of story. You know, he didn't really go into apologizing to the housekeeper, and that was one of the things. And the same thing with Elliot Spitzer, he apologized to his family, but he didn't apologize.
Is that true?
To the woman.
Oh, I don't know. I didn't know that.
And
then I
guess,
take back what I said.
She was a woman of the night, but still.
Love that expression, woman of the night. By the way, am I right? I don't want to make a mistake again because it was a long time ago. Tiger Woods, that was that endless apology. Didn't it go on for like days at that press conference? And by the way, if I recall correctly, the part of that I think was most convinced, you remember who was sitting in the front row? I hope I'm right about this. When he did that apology at that press conference,
I don't.
His mother.
Oh, his
and
mother.
I'll tell you, having your and maybe some people I think said it was a CYA kind of thing, basically to show if my mother. It's sort of like the Lena Dunham thing we were talking about yesterday, where the woman whose rape case she undercut by saying she had inside information that would exculpate the rapist in this case, had the mother of the woman with her at the press conference, which I guess was really to show that she'd been forgiven.
Here's one of my favorites.
What's that?
We all remember Senator Larry Craig. He was a big crusader
wide
for
stance
morality,
guy, wasn't he?
And you know, you couldn't be gay, and you know, pro-life, and all these upstanding
things. He was a senator from where? Nebraska, was he, or something?
I forget where he's from. Somewhere out in the Midwest.
Idaho. Yeah.
Anyway, he was found in a men's room.
Yes, he was.
Minneapolis airport, signaling to other people. Idaho. He was signaling to other people in the restroom that he was interested in some sort of sexual encounter. So when he gets caught, he says, first, let me apologize to my family, my friends, staff, and fellow Idahoans for the cloud placed over Idaho. I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport. I regret my decision to plead guilty and the sadness that decision has brought to my wife, family, friends, staff, and fellow Idahoans. Let me be clear. I am not gay and have never been.
That's a good apology.
So
that's a good one.
I guess the fact that he was looking for men for a sexual encounter had nothing to do with any kind of sexual preference or anything.
You know what
like
I realized also? What's a universal theme in bad apologies? If anyone was offended, as opposed to, again, directly apologizing to those who clearly were. Linda, you're in Rhode Island. You're next on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library. Hey there.
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Thank you for calling. What's up?
I think this is a great topic, and the thing that concerns me is that what might be an acceptable apology to me, or you for that matter, doesn't necessarily mean it's acceptable to a whole swath of people.
You are brilliant. That's so true.
Out,
yeah. Go ahead.
Until we figure out as a country what really is and isn't acceptable and how one discerns that, you know, we're all going to have this incident. In this case, it's Kevin Hart. The other day, it was Leah Dunham. It really doesn't matter. I think that's what troubles me, is that, and I'll give you my best example, which is Bill Clinton. As a lifelong Democrat, I can honestly say I'm still waiting this many years later for this man who's beloved all around the world to step up and give a full-throated, sincere public apology to his wife and the country, and yet a lot of people are willing to forgive that.
By the way, I don't think he's as celebrated across this world today as he once was.
The Morning Dad column, which talked about how
there is a piece on Sunday in the New York Times written by maybe the most vicious columnist in America, and I mean that in a loving way. It's called Curtains for the Clintons, and it's a play. Let me just finish the thought, if I may. It's a play on the fact that when they did the first stop on their tour, which is coming to Boston in April, by the way, their joint tour of the two Clintons, there were so few people in the audience in Toronto, I think it was, Marjorie, that they had to put curtains everywhere so it didn't look like there was nobody there. And
right.
She proceeds to talk about what you're talking about how Bill Clinton has never really been able to say what he needed to say. Maybe not to be forgiven, but at least to be believed that there is real sorrow or contrition. Linda, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. And by the way, I think he has paid a price. He's still a former president. He's living a fine life. Would you not say he's paid a price because he didn't give a sincere apology? Again, the issue is whether Lewinsky and the other women forgive him. But there's never been anything close to a sincere apology. Not only has he suffered, I would argue Hillary Clinton has suffered because of the way she treated the women who, I think we believe, credibly accused him of sexual misconduct. No?
And just yesterday we were talking about how he used to fly around with Jeffrey Epstein on the Lolita
Express,
as he called his private jet. So maybe he wasn't as sincere as he meant to be.
You know what I did last night after the show? I read more about that. I read the whole Miami Herald story, which I had only read part of before yesterday's show. The fact that Acosta, who was then the U.S. attorney, allowed this plea deal in this case of what is clearly serial rape of minors in the Epstein case.
Some as young as middle school.
And he's now the Secretary of Labor for the United States. It's unconscionably horrible.
Well, the president said he was going to clean up the swamp. And clearly, he's done it. Anyway, we're talking about Kevin Hart, asking you at what point should we no longer be held accountable for past transgressions if we've made amends? The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If you're just tuning in, we were using Kevin Hart as a jumping-off point. He backed out of hosting next year's Oscars about a day after he agreed to it, after a series of homophobic tweets and comments were excavated, most of them a bunch of years old, seven, 8 years. The Academy told Hart, apologize, you don't host. He opted for the latter, not hosting, saying, at least on Instagram, that he already apologized. If you want to talk about Kevin Hart, it's fine. We're less interested in that, but rather more interested in him being the hook for a larger discussion about when one should be, I don't know if forgiven is the right word, but when is an apology enough? I just got an angry email saying you shouldn't be making jokes about this, and the thing they thought I was making a joke about was Mario Batali. That was not a joke. When Mario Batali, the famous chef and food guy, apologized for his sexual misconduct, at the end of his apology, he did include a recipe for a cinnamon bun, which I would argue, no matter how heartfelt it is, it's sort of an indication that you don't totally get it. The number is 877-301-8970. If you just tuned in, we're not talking about Harvey Weinstein-level crimes. We're talking about things more like the Kevin Hart thing. The tweets were offensive. They're 8 or 9 years old, and I, for one, should say that if it turns out that there had been a heartfelt apology rather than this Instagram thing where he basically said, I did it, I'll pass, I'm not going to apologize again, I would be much more forgiving than I feel right now.
Well, I'm getting mixed email from gay men. Here's one
saying
from
what?
Garrett, who says...
About Hart or about things...
About Hart.
Yeah.
30-year-old gay man here, who cares? This is the kind of symbolic garbage that makes us feel better but changes nothing. Thank goodness a homophobe won't host the Oscars. I can't I can stop clutching my pearls now. And Michael said, as a gay man, I found his comments disgusting and wrong. His apology was not sincere. Homophobia has serious consequences for young people, and we should stand strong against him. So there you go, divided opinion there on the email. Let's go to Joanna in the car. Hi, Joanna.
Hey there.
Hi. I'd say, actually, that the apology and an honest apology is extremely important. But for myself, I'm a parent of a transgender son, now adult, and I had no clue at the beginning of, you know, my experience with that. And I'm sure I, you know, said some insensitive things.
You mean about transgender people or by and about and to your son? What do you mean?
Just over the years, as you know, we grew with understanding myself and family what transgender and all. It also brought up, I learned so much just about, you know, humanity and relationships and sexuality and transgender. And, you know, there's a learning curve. You know, we human beings go through learning curves. And I think, you know, we have to cut each other slack for being, you know, humans in that. But that said, when he avoided apologizing, I did find that a little offensive.
You know, I think that's a great and honest point, Joanna, because I think a lot of people don't know trans people. They haven't had many interactions with trans people. And I think if you haven't, and you may have a lot of, you know, uninformed biases. That's what I'm saying before.
Well, I would say I'm with Joanna. I probably did too, and I've learned a lot.
Yeah.
But you said it at the beginning, evolution happens.
You want to evolve.
Well, you know what's a good example of this?
I have a very difficult time in apologizing to my sister. You know, it's very difficult for me
to your sister?
Yeah, I think sometimes siblings, you really can't bear to apologize.
What'd you do to her?
Well, I leaned back against the stove once and broke the handle off it.
That is a hell of a transgression.
Wasn't a big thing. It wasn't a big thing, but it's like I was like lifting Mount Everest to say,
"She not forgiven
sorry,
you for
I
it?
Did it." No, it's 5 years and she still hasn't forgiven me.
Well, I think you should apologize by saying if I offended anyone by leaning on the stove, my heartfelt,
yeah,
whatever.
Okay.
877-301-8970. By the way, if you've got a favorite apology, one you think really worked, or one like Laura Ingram's after Parkland that clearly did not work, you can share that with us too. Daniel, you're in Salem. You're on Boston Public Radio with me, Jim Browdy, and Marjorie Egan. How are you?
I'm well. How are you guys?
Excellent. Good. Thank you for calling. What's up?
Good. So I may or may not have had occasion to apologize a number of times in my life. You know, I'm unique in that way.
Go ahead.
But I have concluded that an apology needs to have three fundamental elements to accomplish the goal.
What are they?
You have to state what you did wrong.
Amen.
You have to define it so that the other person agrees. Because otherwise, you're just, I'm sorry. For what? What are you sorry? Like, why are you sorry? You need to define so that the other person that you're apologizing to agrees with you what you're apologizing about. Second, you need to express your remorse for it. You need to say, you know, I'm sorry because I know it offended you, because I know it hurt your feelings. Like, you need to express why you're sorry for it. And third, you need to tell them you're not going to do it again. Otherwise, I don't think you've accomplished the goal.
Are you a shrink or something? Or what? Are you just an expert?
Not even close.
Apologies.
I'm a real estate agent.
So it sounds like you've had an occasion to apologize more than once. Is that a fair statement?
It is a fair statement, but not in real estate, more in my personal life.
By the way, I think that was a perfect list, actually. And I guess was in there. You didn't use the word, but it's the thing I mentioned before. Showing real empathy, showing a real understanding of how you hurt the other person or the people who were at the other end of your inappropriate behavior. But I think you nailed it there,
Are you
Daniel.
A good apologizer, Jim?
Who?
Are you a good apologizer?
Yeah, but it takes me a while to get there. Oh, you're making fun of me. I'm sorry. I didn't know you were ridiculing me. If I'd known you were ridiculing me, I would have answered differently.
So it takes you a while to get there, but eventually you do for the most part.
For the most part.
Okay, that's
But it
very
does. I mean, to be candid, it does take, because you really have to be humble.
And I think it depends on who you're apologizing to.
It does.
Yeah.
Am I supposed to apologize to you for something?
No, you're quite good at apologizing.
Actually, I'm good. Every time I interrupt her, which is every day. The end of the show at 2 o'clock, as soon as we're off the air, I apologize. And by the way, what I've done is I've done prospective apologies with you. I said, I apologize for what I did today and for any time I interrupt you in the future.
That's right.
Our career, as long as it lasts. Zane, you are in my hometown of Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for calling. Hi. Zane.
Hi. Can you guys hear me?
We can. Yeah. Thank you for calling. What's up?
Okay. I think apologizing is very important. The words are very important. I think what's more important is demonstrating something. So, I mean, for instance, Kevin Hart. I mean, obviously his original comments were based on some biases. Now, he has apologized, but we don't know how he still feels about these biases. Mm-hmm. Had he gone out to some clubs or in other of his many of his other Hollywood things, if he had actually said something or done something to demonstrate that he is over that bias, then his apology, future apology, you can say, well, he's gotten over it. We all learn. We all have biases. It's okay to have a bias. That's part of being human. But I think more importantly is, once you understand that your bias is wrong, you actually have to demonstrate, in my mind, you have to demonstrate and show that I'm over that by some act, especially somebody who's as public as he is.
So are you saying, Zane, that words are never enough? Is that what I'm reading in this, that you got to act in a way that demonstrates your sincerity? Is that what you're trying to say?
I think for somebody in such a public situation, it absolutely is.
Got it.
In terms of somebody in private life, you certainly hope that if you're apologizing to your boyfriend or girlfriend for whatever mistakes you've made, you are, as others have talked, you have to be humble and all that. But, you know, all that, a lot of this can be feigned. On the other hand, if you truly demonstrate that, okay, I made a mistake, I called a homeless man something weird, but now I'm going to go to a homeless mm-hmm. shelter and actually do something about it. That, to me, is a lot more authentic than just words.
Well, especially if you don't invite a reporter to cover your good deeds. That's a wonderful point, Zane. You know what? You know, Marjorie, you say about once a week that you take every opportunity to say something good about Donald Trump that you can, since we don't say many good things. Did you hear his comments the day after the National Cathedral funeral, not yesterday's funeral in Texas, about George H.W. Bush? They were so...
I forget.
It didn't sound like the usual hostage video when he says something good. You mm-hmm. can see he's reading carefully. He not only praised them in ways that sounded sincere, he singled out 8 Holocaust victims who were at some event he was doing at the White House. And you know what I was thinking in a moment of rare feeling of charity towards this president? That if he had had it in him to go one step further and say, you know, Bush's death has caused me to reflect about what I said about members of his family, and I may not be able to ever undo the whatever. I know he's not an apology kind of guy. It really would have been maybe a major moment, and because he really came close. When you hear yesterday, I wish I'd asked for the sound. It really sounded like, not only was it sincere, it sounded like, as I said, that he wasn't reading a script, which... So it was something, but it wasn't
enough. Well, I think a lot of people wondered about that. When you sit in a cathedral for 2 hours and you listen to someone be eulogized like H.W. Bush was, and about his courage and his dignity and his how he helped people and didn't ridicule people, I mean, you have to think maybe some of that might have sunk in, and you would compare your own actions to that kind of thing. By the way, Paul sent us the list from the 12 steps. Step 8. Make a list of all persons we've harmed and become willing to make amends to them. All step 9, make direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when doing so would injure them or others. So you got to go up to them and apologize.
Hard.
It's really hard. And you know, it could take an awful long time. You have to make a list of all of all the people you've harmed. It might be a long list. It might take you years.
We only have time for one more call. And Bob from Canton, you are it. Hello, Bob. Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, I'm here.
What's up?
I'm here. I've been listening, long-term listener, first-time caller.
Thank you for both.
Thank you.
And I just wanted to say that we're talking about apologies in light of the fact that we have a gentleman in the White House that has been accused of 19... acts of sexual aggression, who has done nothing except call the women liars.
That is correct.
That's true. He kind of fell down on that front.
You can't apologize if you don't admit you've committed the act, and he denies that any of the credible accusations are credible. But we agree with you. It's a perfect way to end it. Bob, thanks for your first call. Please call us again soon.
Okay, coming up. I can't wait for this. The rise, fall, and complicated legacy of a prize fighter, Emile Griffith. He's the subject of the play Man in the Ring, We're going to talk to the star of that play and the playwright up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. The true story of Emil Griffith, the six-time world champion boxer, is the subject of a terrific new play called Man in the Ring. It's an immigrant story. It's a story about a bisexual man trying to make it in the savage and brutal world of boxing. It's a story about regret and what happens to the mind and memory when debilitating dementia takes over. Man in the Ring is presented by the Connington Theater Company. It's on stage now through December 22nd at the Calderwood Pavilion, again, through December 22nd. We're joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright behind this, Michael Christopher. Michael, it's great to meet you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And one of the two lead actors who plays Griffith as a young man and is brilliant, Kyle Vincent Terry. Kyle, it's great to meet you, too.
Great
Thanks
to be
for being
here. Thank you.
So either one of you could answer this. Jim just kind of gave an idea of the story of Emil Griffith, but it's much more complicated than that. Do you want to start being the guy who wrote this whole thing?
Yeah, it's an extraordinary story of a man's life, a life that was full of contradictions. A young man who came from St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands in search of his mother who had abandoned him. Came to New York, wanted to be a baseball player and a singer, and also had a talent for creating women's hats.
Which is true, by the way. Yeah. It's not facetious.
I didn't lie. The script doesn't lie. We take a lot of liberties because we tell the story from the older Emil's point of view, and it's when he was 70-some years old, and because of his fighting career, and also because he was attacked and mugged and brutally beaten, he was slipping into dementia at the last part of his life. And the story of the play is really the story of a man trying to make sense of his life and seeking a kind of peace for all the things that he had done and for all the things that had happened to him. And so we see all these earlier events of the life of his life through his sort of demented dreams, and that gives us the structure for the play.
What did you know about Griffith, Kyle, when you were hired to do this thing?
I actually didn't know much. I spoke to my dad about it. My dad was a boxing fan, and he was very aware, not nearly as in-depth as the play goes into, but the minute I read the story, I was captivated just that someone like this exists. And so I did my due diligence. I did the reading. I started training harder. I'm usually in pretty good shape, but this is...
Oh, yeah? You think so? When you took your shirt off, there was like whole audience was like,
Yes, that did happen.
This was also true of Emil. Right. He was an extraordinary looking person, there were a lot of reactions to his physical prowess and his beauty. So we were very lucky to find somebody who had all that.
You know, Michael, one of the things I read, which it was amazing. I mean, you've obviously won a Pulitzer Prize, and you've been in a million unbelievable things, in them, written them, whatever. You didn't know about... You were alive at the time. I was telling Marjorie, I actually watched the fight live as a kid.
Really?
On whatever it was, Friday Night Boxing. Right. And I didn't know... Obviously, we didn't know at the time that Brett had been killed. He didn't die for a week.
10 days, yeah.
10 days. We knew he was badly hurt.
Yeah.
But and I knew nothing about Griffith other than that fight. You didn't know anything about this until you were hired to write the story?
No, I was brought the story. I had worked with Terrence Blanchard, who is a fantastic jazz musician from New Orleans and a composer of film scores, does a lot of the Spike Lee films. He and I worked together on a film that I directed called Gia for HBO with Angelina Jolie. And so we were friends, and he was commissioned by Opera Theatre St. Louis to write an opera in jazz. And he was very excited to do it. And he has been a boxing aficionado for years, and he knew the Emil Griffith story. And he came to me and said, would you work on the libretto for the opera? And that's how I was introduced.
So you were blind about it. You knew nothing about him until you started reading up to do this libretto.
No, and there was a strange connection between his being sort of the same age that I was at the time that I found out about him. There was a whole connection in terms of his struggling with his sexuality through the 50s and the 60s. There was just this strange, although he's so totally different from me in so many ways, there was a really strong connection to the story of his life.
Boy, does it come through.
We're talking about Man in the Ring. It's now at the Huntington Theater, and we're joined by Michael Christopher, the playwright.
Christopher, excuse me.
And Kyle Vincent Terry, who's one of the lead, plays Emil as a young man. What I thought was, there were so many really neat things about this, but one of them is that you two, the young Emil and the older Emil, played by John Douglas Thompson,
who is also
were
brilliant.
On the stage together at the same time.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, it's great because you have this fantastic opportunity to get an echo back of what you're doing. And so the process of creating this character starts many, many weeks, months out. But then you come into the room and there's this other person playing the same person. And so a lot of the discovery was navigating choices John was making and choices I was making, and then us being fascinated with each other and saying, okay, well, what is this person doing? Or how does this person carry their hands? Or what tics do they have? And then marrying that with dialect and drive, and then getting to find my way from a very young Emil to somewhere closer to John's age over the course of the show. I think it just led to a deepening that can be less reflective than when it's just you playing the character.
Yeah.
Oh,
there's
really
just there's constantly a reference as to how the story is moving over time.
Well, how did you decide to do that? Because I'm not an expert on the theater, but it seems to me that was unusual.
It is an unusual idea. And the thing is about the story that really turned me on was, I'm a great fan of a lot of writing that's being done right now in the theater and the fantastic writers who are producing extraordinary plays. But this is a very sort of old-fashioned play. I mean, it harkens back to really the sort of early Greek drama. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do a play, which I had never done before, a play that involved sound, light, music, dance, all of these sort of non-realistic things that make for an evening of theater, because Emil's life, although the facts of his life may be, you could interpret them as being really sad, the truth about him was that he was a funnel for joy. Mm-hmm. He was known for his smile. He always brought a kind of fantastic energy into the room, and I wanted the play to do that too, and that's why I used lots of different sort of styles, used music. The fight scenes are choreographed. It's not realistic.
No, it's not.
Not at all.
No, it's not. And I was saying before we went on the air how I was kind of, I'm worried about seeing this being in the 10th row, 20 feet from people, a boxing, because it obsessed me. But it was choreographed. Tell us how you did that.
Well, the first thing is you have to know boxing, right? Like, I don't think there's a way to abstract or expressionistically paint that painting without actually knowing the fundamentals. And then from there, you construct the phrasing, similar as to how you would structure a sentence. I say this, you respond. I say this, you respond. And then we get to blow it up. And it just so happens that we have all this technical wizardry around us to help. But our fight choreographers, Rick Sordele and Christian Kelly Sordele, and Gary Stark Jr., a boxing consultant, helped us find ways of telling that story in a theatrical way that allowed certain phrasing to pop But a lot of it is just the discipline of going into boxing and knowing how that functions.
Yeah. But were you a boxing fan? We know that,
yeah,
Michael, you
absolutely
have
been. I've been doing martial arts my whole life.
You are. And so as a participant, do you watch fight? Do you watch boxing? Or?
Yeah. And I've been training in New York for a while. There's nothing like when somebody hits you with the Vaseline and you're like, okay, it's about to go down. Somebody's
but
about
you
to hit me.
You don't see that awful thing where someone gets punched and then their head goes like, you know, over to the, and you just get,
well, there is the video there, behind the a, actual fight,
is.
Right? And that's the backdrop against which you and John are doing your thing.
It's much more like dancing.
Yes.
It's much more like ballet.
Yes.
It's much more like sort of orchestrated movement, you know?
There's not much difference.
No.
Right? Like, and that's the thing. I danced professionally
for
a long time. There's less blood.
Less blood.
unless you're looking at feet.
Okay.
But it is the choreography of the thing. And then when you just separate people enough,
right,
like it becomes kind of magical as opposed to just like visceral. And the thing that you're describing that makes us wince and fear for the performer as opposed to dreaming into the character.
That's right. You could dream into the character. That's perfectly said.
So can I continue my sycophantic review of this, if I may? You mentioned music before. By the way, for those who haven't seen it yet, and you really should, you have till December 22nd. Plus, the cold wood is great. It's intimate. It's all
You're
those
close.
Great.
You're very
it's
close.
It's really great. It's not a musical. I don't want people.
No.
There's it's sort of like a Greek kind of thing in the environment.
Well, there's two things. One is that the music is used as a kind of chorus, the way the way the Greeks used music, and it's not a musical. But what I used was the fact that when people are slipping into dementia, often their near memory is not good, but their far term memory is very good, and I stumbled on all these Caribbean songs and games that children play. And then I stumbled on one of the songs, which was which goes, "There's a brown boy in the ring."
Yeah.
Which was like,
that's how it opens, isn't it? Him singing it.
Yeah. And it's a game. So although the play is entitled "Man in the Ring," it's not only about a man in a boxing ring. It's about a child in a ring that's being danced in a game, in a children's game. So that's how the music came into the play.
Do you wear, obviously, I'm talking to Michael Christopher when I'm asking this question. Are you anxious when you're writing about something where there is a factual history and you came into it knowing nothing about it, and obviously you got up to speed and then some, is there anxiety about portraying it accurately while portraying it artistically? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I've done several sort of biography plays or film scripts, and it is tricky because you want to be accurate to a certain extent, but the truth is, when you're writing something that is a biography of another person, you finally are writing about yourself, and that's the final sort of test of what you're doing that is true or not true. It's about how much of you have you put into it.
What did you think of his performance?
Wow.
I know it's a pretty tough question, but. What did you think of
it? It is phenomenal. He and John both are doing something that I haven't seen on the stage in a long time.
What's
and,
that?
And it's the fact of embodying a sort of dynamic, complex, dual character thing that not only tells the story of a sort of tragedy, but the response from the audience to these two guys, the laughter that we get, you know, and then toward the end of the show, the tears. I mean, grown men breaking down in the audience from the story. It's a very special thing to see two men create one character and sort of have done it so beautifully.
By the way, that's the voice of Michael Christopher, who wrote this Man in the Ring, which is terrific. Kyle Vincent Terry plays Emil Griffith as a young man.
And John Douglas Thompson plays him as an older man. And when I watched a lot of those scenes, when he couldn't find his shoe, which turned out to be in the refrigerator,
that's a
and
great
the
scene.
Explosive moments where he lunged at his longtime lover. I could think of
Luis, right? Is that the name of the character?
Yeah,
Luis.
Yeah.
I could think of the you hear about the NFL players now with losing their minds and getting very violent and scaring their spouses and their children.
It's CTE with Griffith too. Was it not?
They didn't call it then. Yeah. Didn't they call it
dementia?
Dementia pugilistic.
Yes, that's it.
Well, it's interesting because my grandfather passed away with severe dementia, and so those moments of violence into like that childlike quality again was just something we've been dealing with for the last 10 years and 15 years. And as it escalates, it becomes a much more harrowing experience to go through. But there's, you know, getting to see in the show the glimmers of it, and then the more intense peaks and valleys of it is pretty close to me as well.
So were you not, you know, so you didn't know about Griffith. You're about the same age as I am. You were never, I mean, I was a huge Ali fan. I saw every closed circuit fight. I was in law school. I saved every penny, and I was at Ali Frazier 1 in Madison Square Garden. Maybe the most exciting night of my, I'm a Philly boy, but I was rooting for Ali, not the hometown kid,
Jim,
Frazier.
You were quite a boxer
oh,
yourself.
Oh, that's funny, Marjorie. That's really funny. Thank you. But were you not into Ali? Were you not, I mean, there was this moment, that's not boxing, it's Ali, and then there was everybody else.
Well, Ali was show business.
Yeah.
So it was easy to be into Ali. But no, I had no...
Because of the violence? Like, that's why Marjorie doesn't like this. Is it because of the violence or just didn't interest
No, it was you? Just never something. My father was never interested in it, and we were interested in other sports. So I just never pursued it.
He was busy being a playwright, Jim. Yeah. Yeah. Break.
And my father went into dementia, too, in the last 5 years of his life. So that was another thing that connected me to the story and to... what was going on with Emil at that time. But no, I'm sorry. I didn't know.
You know, speaking of you, Kel, though, you mentioned your grandfather. And sure. Eddie, do you have to see a little... Do you have to find in a character, when you immerse yourself in him, like you and your colleague did into Griffith, do you have to find a piece of him in you to do what
Absolutely.
You did?
I think what's great about this story, and very important, is having people who look like me run the gamut, because I grew up as an artist, I grew up as an athlete, and one thing that I noticed I had in common were all of these facets of my personality that I wanted to explore. And the thing that like dropped me in was the thought of, what if my parents didn't let me do those things, right? Like, what if they just said, no, you have to do this, you have to take care of your family, which happens to many people, right? Like, you forego, and there's a poem, Harlem, by Langston Hughes, mm-hmm. right? We all know the raisin in the sun part, but the last line is, italics, or does it explode, right? What happens to a dream deferred? And so connecting those dots is the drop-in point of allowing myself to go on the ride and dream big as young Emil, and then give myself the opportunity to not let it happen for me.
And I should say, when I said you play the young Emil compared to your colleague, I mean, and as you said, as Emil ages too, as a kid, as a young, wildly successful boxer, as an aging boxer who is not doing so terribly well through 100 and some
fights. But you know, one of the things at the beginning of the play, when you first come and you get your suit on, you're looking so dashing with your baseball dancing around the stage. You know, you meet the guy that in the millinery that was the foreign boxer that becomes
a great too.
And you also get it how difficult it was to be a gay man or a bisexual man then, because you know it seemed to me that the guy that in the millinery that wanted him to became kind of his coach sort of. He knew he was gay or bisexual, and just said, there's none of that.
There's no room for it.
Yeah, there's no room for that in this world.
And
ridiculed the hats, because you had the hats that you made.
Yeah. It's a heartbreaking scene, I think, in the play, where the coach, who is a real father figure to young Emil, refuses to hear him say what is truly going on with him. It's very much what the play is about, which is trying to find out who you are and then be who you are, and the struggle, as Kyle's saying, is that sometimes, you know, people don't get to do that.
Well, he wanted to be a singer and a baseball player, not a boxer, right?
Yeah. He did record for Columbia Records. Yeah.
Fantastic songs.
Is that really true? Could he sing?
I have them.
Yeah,
you do?
They're great. Yeah, yeah. They're really good.
What kind of music?
It's pop. It's sort of like pop. Tempo pop.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah.
It's very, you hear it, and it's very catchy.
But that was a sense I got, maybe I was wrong, that he really didn't want to be a boxer. The idea of beating someone to a pulp, which is why he was so devastated, was not really something that gave him much pleasure.
I think it's tough. I think it's hard to marry yourself to just the simple context of I don't want to do something. I think there is a thing of like I have larger aspirations. I'm good at this thing, but I also have these larger aspirations. Like in that scene with the mother where he says, I'm good at a lot of things. I want to do those things too, right? And I think, you know, when you're kept into a small container, it's a lot harder to figure out what exactly you're supposed to do.
So what happens in this thing on December 23rd? I don't think I want to know the answer. What I mean, December 22nd in the Calderwood, and then does it disappear into the vapor? Or where do you go with this thing? It's so good. Where does it go?
That's the most depressing thing I've ever heard. That's right. I wish I knew. I mean, this is show business,
right.
You know? It's
right.
Also a business, and we're trying very hard. I mean, I initially did the play in Chicago. Mm-hmm. We had a production there, and now this production, and you hope and hope and hope and work very hard to find a way to have the play have a life so that more people can see it.
Sure.
I mean, what's happening to audiences when they watch this play is just something that hasn't happened to me since I wrote The Shadow Box, you know, 20-some years ago, 30-some years ago. I mean, it feels to me it's important that we get the story out
Absolutely.
There and that we find other productions. And, yeah, I mean, we would love to get it to New York because that would mean if it's done in New York, other cities would do it around the country. So we have big hopes.
Well, you have a bias. I don't. I didn't write it, and I hope every word that you just said comes true. It is terrific. You are terrific.
Thank
You're
you.
A fellow
Thank
actor.
You.
It is really a wonderful night at the theater. It's great to
Thanks.
Meet you, gentlemen.
Thank
okay.
you so much
for being
here.
I'm going to give everybody the info now when they want to see go to the play. Before that, actor Kyle Vincent Terry portrays real-life boxing champ Emile Griffith in the play Man in the Ring. Michael Christopher. Sorry about that earlier mistake.
Nicely done.
Is the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright who wrote it. Man in the Ring is on stage now through December 22nd, as Jim said, at the Calderwood Pavilion, presented by the Huntington Theater Company. To learn more, go to huntingtontheater.org. Kyle and Michael, thank you very,
Pleasure.
Very much
thank
for coming
you
in.
Much
Congratulations.
Thanks very much.
Go see it, everybody. It is really great.
Coming up, Emily Rooney is here with her famous list of preoccupations and proclamations, and also to celebrate her 20 years of Beat the Press. You listen to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
At noon on today's BPR, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. It's been a week since President George H.W. Bush died, and the media continues to talk about his life and legacy. Has the coverage been over the top? Is it really a not-so-subtle rebuke of Trump, or is this what a public servant of Bush's stature deserves? At noon, Emily Rooney joins us for this, her famous list, hours before her 20th anniversary show at Beat the Press. Mark Twain said humor is the good-natured side of a truth. Well, it can also be bad-natured. Harvard Business School researchers have looked inside the inside joke and how people can use it to alienate others. We'll talk to them about it, and then you taking your calls on what it's like to literally be put out of humor.
Ryan Landry joins us to go over the latest PC police blotter, including whether Baby It's Cold Outside, that wintertime classic, should be banished from the airwaves. All that is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Friday, and as we do every Friday, we broadcast live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
So joining us for a list of fixations and fulminations is Emily Rooney, host of Beat the Press, which, let me say this slowly, marks its 20-year anniversary today with a live broadcast at 7 o'clock. Congratulations,
hey,
Emily.
Hey, thanks, Jim.
It's
thanks,
really
Mark.
Great.
I know. We're all very
amazing,
excited.
Really.
We
it
are.
It is amazing.
Really,
Jim's we're, more excited than I am.
I may be. I am so excited about this. I can't. I'm gone. I'm going to be in the audience. It's really great. We're going to talk more about those years with you in a handful of minutes after we talk about some current events.
Well, Jim and I were talking yesterday about all these guys that seem to be getting away with things. Weinstein may not be going to jail. Harvey Weinstein. There was that terrible story about this Jeffrey Epstein from Florida, who was soliciting middle school girls.
He's a serial child rapist.
He did do a year or something, didn't
13
he?
13 months
yeah.
in a county jail.
In a private,
with
where he had his own computer.
His own security, and he got 12 hours out a day to go to the office.
Yeah, it was a joke. It was a total joke, and the guy who's now the head of the Labor Department in the Trump administration is the federal prosecutor who oversaw that ridiculous deal he got. But now we have new news about the firing of Jeff Fager, the executive producer of 60 Minutes. They said it was justified. He was fired earlier, and they've looked into this.
I think the one that shocked me, that's today's business section in the New York Times, that Don Hewitt was, he was the original executive producer of 60 Minutes. He, in his name, they've already paid one woman, I could probably find out who it is, $5 million. And she keeps renegotiating every year. In addition, they have agreed to pay her $75,000 until her death, $75,000 a year. But they've already paid her $5 million. So this is a problem that went way, way back at CBS and 60 Minutes. And they're basically saying that the culture at 60 Minutes was not that it was nobody felt like it was sort of a runaway train, sexism, but they reported to Les Moonves. They didn't even report to the news division because they were such an important entity unto themselves. So a lot of this behavior.
Did you ever have a hint of this from your father?
No,
or?
No, absolutely.
And you obviously knew Hewitt.
Oh, I did. I was shocked about Don Hewitt for some reason.
You know what I wonder? You know, with
certainly not my father.
Roger Ailes, Les Moonves, this guy Jeff Fager, all these guys that were in very important positions in terms of network broadcasting, how it may have shaped their whole view of women candidates, stories about women, that you had such
That's
little respect
point.
For women.
You know, Jeff Fager shouldn't really be lumped in. I mean, there were a couple of incidents with him. One was he approached some woman at a Christmas party. He was obviously had a few drinks, and he tried to kiss her or something like that. But he wasn't, like, groping people. One woman said he groped her, but the reason he got fired was because he's fired off that memo, and then he denied doing it. He probably had a couple of beers, and he was threatening a reporter who was going to cover the story.
Yeah, well, that was pretty creepy.
That was bad. Yeah.
So I get you wonder how they had a warped view of half the human race.
Yeah, I wonder what Leslie Stahl makes of all of that, because, I mean, she's been there forever now. I mean, she felt it. She's, you know.
Well, you know what? I quoted you yesterday. I hope I didn't misquote you. When we first started talking about Les Moonves, before his fall from grace, even though I would argue making $69 million a year is not a horrible fall. I mean, he's not making it anymore. But weren't you the one who said to us, I'm curious to know, and we need to know what the executives knew and when they knew.
I've
mean,
said
that's
that all along.
The untold story.
Well, they are
here.
The executives.
No, but I mean, they're boards of directors. Yeah. People obviously have to know this kind of stuff is going on.
Clearly,
and the penalty you pay, I understand statutes of limitations, is you lose your job. End of story. And while I hear people say it's horrible, you can't work it, who cares? People like Moonves. I mean, he basically ran sexual predator operation inside the news department.
And people were rewarded by whatever sexual favors they...
Including that one woman who the lawyer's report suggests was purely on the payroll to give him oral sex.
Don't you really wonder about Julie Chen? Didn't he approach her the same way? You know, what's the old cliche?
His wife, by the way, for those who don't know.
Who also hosts Big Brother. I mean, he was married when he started dating her. Didn't he come on to her the same way? She must be scratching her head going, huh, this sounds familiar.
Let me just say one thing. The one thing it does say in the report, at least from the New York Times retelling of the report yesterday, is that these behaviors, I'm not defending him at all, I'm just stating what they say was a fact, ended. This predatory behavior ended when he married her. It doesn't mean that she shouldn't have known, but allegedly he didn't continue for the last, whatever it was, 13 years they've been together. Exactly.
But you know, you always think people know, and you said your father didn't know. He was at 60 Minutes
he might
forever.
Have.
He might have. Okay. Because I think often it's a small circle that knows, and that enables people like all these women at Fox that defended Roger Ailes to get out there and defend him. Oh, well, he never touched me, which has nothing to do with whether he touched somebody else. But I think that that people did not necessarily tell. You know?
Yeah, but people knew about it. That doesn't, just because you're not, and especially women must have told some of their friends, they must have confided, the rumors had to have gotten back. I mean, Matt Lauer, you can't tell, you cannot convince me that Andy Lack and some of those guys at NBC didn't know that he had been accused of these things. Of course
and
they
didn't know that he had a button under his desk that allowed him to lock his door
well, that was
from
supposed
a seated
to be
position.
A security. From terrorists.
Oh, yeah.
That were going to...
Yeah.
But that was the excuse for why he got it. I don't know. I'm not convinced, having worked at places where I don't think people did talk about it and they didn't tell people and they didn't know. I mean, I think later on, you say, oh, so-and-so did this to me, and then everybody says, yeah. And then suddenly 12 more women come out and say, they did it, but I don't know that people necessarily talked about it because it was really humiliating.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the culture at 60 Minutes, I wouldn't have been surprised if it was like Mike Wallace or something like that, but I know, but Don Hewitt surprised me.
Thank you for that comment.
I don't know. I mean, I knew his wife. I just... And there was definitely a sense of just indomitable power there. They just didn't report to anybody. That was sort of their whole thing.
That is nothing you can't do. Yeah. And by the way, we said it yesterday. My view is the way the Congress and state legislatures should react is to eliminate statutes of limitations on sexual assault, on rape, and those sort of things. So these guys can't retire with hundreds of millions of dollars in their mansions. Well, if it were federal crimes, that's one thing. But if under state law,
could do it.
They'd have to do it state by state.
The priests.
Right, but that's on the civil side. We haven't eliminated statute of limitations totally. Yeah. We've changed them on criminal cases in Massachusetts, but people should be doing it. In any case, you know, can we move to Fox News from CBS for a second? I thought when we were told, our coworker told us, Chelsea told us about this Tucker Carlson thing. I assume she had it wrong. Tucker Carlson, I assume people know, is now, you know, one of the Fox News stars. He does an interview with Switzerland's leading German language opinion weekly. If I could pronounce it, I would. He's asked about Donald Trump, who he, at least from the occasional time I turn on a show or read about a show, he doesn't have unkind things to say about. He says he can't stand Trump's self-aggrandizement and boasting. And he continues to say what his, meaning Donald Trump's, chief promises were that he would build the wall, defund Planned Parenthood, repeal Obamacare. He hasn't done any of those things. He knows very little about the legislative process, hasn't learned anything, hasn't surrounded himself with people that can get it done, hasn't done all the things you need to do. So it's mostly his fault that he hasn't achieved those things.
You know what's most stunning about this? Is that clearly he's not allowed to say that on Fox.
Well, that is what it's got to be, right?
He said what he believes to this Swiss magazine, which is absolutely every word of it is true.
So how does he go on air?
Hoping no one would see it.
Well, no, I'm serious. How does he go on air tonight or Monday or whatever
it is?
This
has been out a few days.
And praise every single thing Donald Trump does. And they also mentioned that the interesting thing is he just wrote a book, which I was unaware of, I must say, in which there is no criticism of Donald Trump. So obviously he just exploded on the scene.
It'd be interesting to see if any of his guests ask him about it. Because is he going to bring it up? Is he going to say, well, I just wanted to clarify an interview?
Well, how does he have any credibility if it turns out he is praising everything Trump does?
But you know what Fox does when they have these big stories that break poorly for the president? They just ignore them. They go do a story about, I tuned in the other night and they were doing, Laura Ingraham was doing something about these two women debating about taking down some Confederate statue somewhere. It was totally not the news of the day. They just pretend it didn't happen. Fox and Friends does the same thing in the morning. So I would imagine a lot of the times, and also some of the people that get on Fox, they're not people that are going to go up against the host.
He does have an occasional person on, more than an occasional person on the other side. You make a great point. If he's defending Trump in a debate with a couple of guests, the first thing that guest would do, would quote him to him.
Yeah.
So,
I don't know. I think that lots of times the liberal guests they have on that show are just like these shows.
Wouldn't you love to know what the Fox executive said to him?
Think about this afterwards? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But you make an interesting point, which I hadn't thought about. It probably is that he has been told that he can't say those kind of things on the air, even though Shep Smith is...
Well, that's one of the great mysteries of all time.
Well, Shep does a straight news show, though.
Yeah.
So he doesn't really say things. He tries to set the record straight. But he's not critical.
Well, he does editorialize
around. He's been critical about the president. I mean, he's been critical about the wall. He's been critical about these other things, saying this is not a caravan. This is not a bunch of people invading the country.
He puts it in terms that you could say, well, that's just facts. Fact checking.
I guess to me, he's way off the map from where everybody else is at that station. And you turn it on at night, and it's just endless kind of.
He was there before Fox News Channel went on the air. He was working on a show that
he was very good.
With. Yeah,
I mean, they have a lot of good people that are on during the day, but the people on at night is just like Pravda. Well, it is.
You know, before we get to the 20th anniversary, which we do want to get to in some depth. Marjorie and I were talking this morning, and then she talked to you. And this is a sensitive subject, so I want to carefully choose my words about whether TV overdid it with the Bush funeral. And I think when I said it to Marjorie, it sounded, and I said that, and it sounded totally insensitive, which it was. Mm-hmm. But I guess what I was trying to say, I thought about it again. What I was trying to say was, I think the reason, particularly the CNNs of the world, gave it as much coverage, National Cathedral should have been wall to wall. I'm not quarreling, but the second day of funerals in Texas. When they know they're not going to get ratings, my conclusion was, and maybe I'm being unfair, this was purely a vehicle that allowed them to contrast Bush with Trump. It wasn't about George H.W. Bush at the end.
It wasn't altruism.
It was about, it's the perfect prism through which to trash the man they trash nonstop.
I don't know if you read about this, but Terry Moran at ABC and somebody else he was doing commentary with, We're making that point. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know
if
that.
This were a funeral for Donald Trump, he would have said in advance, it'll be the most attended. And then, so they were making fun of the idea that what would happen if it was a Trump funeral. So I agree with you. I mean, I couldn't remember if they did the same thing for Ronald Reagan. I remember Richard Nixon, he died in 94. It was a big thing, but it wasn't 2 days. And I don't ever remember the post office being shut down.
No, nor do I.
I know. I was stunned.
I was stunned about that.
Yeah.
It's a federal holiday?
I guess so.
Well, there was a decision made. I mentioned this before you came when we were, I don't know what we were talking. Oh, we did. We were talking about apologies. And while Donald Trump didn't do it, I was commenting on the fact that I heard the day after the National Cathedral, Donald Trump making what really sounded like a heartfelt tribute, just in a speech he was giving or some occasion, to George H.W. Bush. And as I said to Marjorie at the time, it didn't sound like the usual hostage video when he's reading praise of somebody who's not himself, where you can see every word is stuttered because he doesn't, whatever. It sounded totally legit. And so I don't know
what's going on. My guess is that having attended that funeral and listen to what people were saying about him, he had a turnaround.
Well, that's
because
what Marjorie
he's been criticized,
said.
He's criticized Herbert Walker Bush in the past.
He ridiculed a thousand
dumb.
Points of
yeah,
light
yeah, right.
twice this, in yeah, yeah. July and last month yeah. or a month or so ago. So maybe he, on who knows, maybe this will have a positive
maybe
impact.
Maybe he's decided he's 72. You know, he probably will be, you know, maybe he'll make it to 94 as well. I don't know. He eats a lot of cheeseburgers and he's kind of heavy. But maybe he'll make it. Maybe he's thinking he'd like to get
doesn't
a little
drink,
bit.
Doesn't drink, doesn't smoke.
Like to have a funeral that's not
celebratory.
Well, by the way, if either of you think he's a changed man, I would suggest you read his tweets
on today.
Robert Mueller this morning.
Well,
there are about 4,000 of them.
But he did nominate this guy, William Barr, to be the attorney general, who is an establishment Republican, who served for H.W., and who is not likely to get rid of the Mueller investigation.
How about that Heather Nauert, though?
Well, he wants
former
good-looking.
Fox News
person. Why does he want that?
Because
I
she's
wonder,
good-looking blonde.
I know, exactly.
To send to the U.N.?
You don't think that's what this is
about? That's the
total
reason, but I'm having a hard time following it.
Because there wasn't another good-looking blonde that was more qualified, I guess, than this ex-Fox News anchor person.
She used to work at the ABC News Bureau in L.A., too, and my brother was telling me that she had... She was trying to do some stand-up, and finally they had, it was like 20 seconds, they finally had to put the whole thing on cue cards. It's like, okay.
Stand-up, for those who don't know, is when you're in front of the camera, occasionally live,
leading
but whatever
to,
it is, yeah, or live was, to tape, where you're just spontaneously, you're ad-libbing your intro or your outro, which is not quite as simple as people think, but if you do that for a living, you should be able to pull it off.
Yeah.
So we don't have a list formally
not
today.
Formally, no.
But, you know, 20 years of Beat the Press, and there really is nothing like it. So what are your reflections today?
So, I mean, it's been kind of strange all week just going back and looking at, you know, how this thing got going, how it's morphed over the years, some of the subtle changes in the program and how we approach it. And one of the most heartening things about it has been how people seem to really get it, because...
What do you mean by get it?
You know, the idea of it is, it sounds kind of exclusive, you know, that it, you only have to be, you have to be in the business to understand, you know, how the sausages mm-hmm. are made, or what's proper critique of your colleagues and that kind of thing. But I think people were drawn to it because it was refreshing, and people were really interested in it.
I asked you last night on television, and we only had limited time. Here we have more time. I find most interesting how this came to be, yeah. because some major figures in the news world, locally and nationally, yeah. touched it. Tell the story. It's on GBH News, by the way. You wrote it. Tell the story for those who haven't seen it.
Well, that started when I was at Channel 5 in the early 80s. Chet Curtis and I and a bunch of other people used to complain all the time about how the media critics in every newspaper all over the region had a media critic. But television was the sole target of their criticism. Mm-hmm. And it was always about the anchors, their salaries.
Right.
It's true.
Chet
it's
loved
trash.
That.
the ratings, what we were doing for sweeps, it was all targeted at television. So I said, you know, I really want to do something that's broader than that. I mean, I thought about it then. And then when I was in New York and I was kind of transitioning, I'd been at ABC, then I was at Fox. And while I was at Fox, I got approached by a guy who... had this very libertarian bent. It was called the Free to Choose Network. And there was a bunch of people that he had gathered in. One of them was Bill Shine.
Who's now at the White House from Fox News.
And David Asman from the Wall Street Journal. Anyway, he asked me if there was any ideas I had, because he was very good at getting money. He had people who would donate money for programs and ideas. And I said, I have this idea. If you know, beat the press, he got $25,000. We do this... pilot at this gorgeous studios in Queens, New York, the Kaufman Astoria. That's where Don Imus' show was done. Sesame Street, a lot of big programs were done out of there. I do the pilot, and then I started shopping it around. That was naive. I should have had somebody shop it for me. Mm-hmm. But I went around, and one of the people I took a meeting with was Roger Ailes, who was then president of CNBC, and he was starting something called America is Talking, which was the America is Talking Network. That eventually became MSNBC, but I had this meeting with him. I don't remember much about it.
Did he make you a proposition?
He was funny. I'll tell you something. Roger is a funny guy. And he was amused by my pilot, but he said to me, I really think I gotta write a book first. Well, thanks a lot. And then I went to Trade Market, and the New York Post printed a story that Arianna Huffington was about to start a program called Beat the Press. Her husband had just lost that big Senate race
in California, spending $16 trillion of his own money.
Yeah. Yeah. It was one of the most expensive Senate races in the history. Now, peanuts compared to now. But so she was about to launch this program called Beat the Press. So we contacted her, and she invited me down. She didn't want to deal with the guy from the Free to Choose Network. So I went down. She made me some pea soup. I can remember sitting in her kitchen. And she said, should we do this together? But she wanted to be... Hers was ideologically based. She wanted to criticize the liberal press. And I said, that's really not what I want to do. I don't want to take a point of view. I just want to, you know, make it even-handed across the board. So I raced her to the trademark office, beat her. And then she trademarked something called Eat the Press. She never did it.
Press.
Yeah. But she did make it a regular segment on the Huffington Post mm-hmm. website. So, and then fast forward a few years, I was here at WGBH. Greater Boston was not on every night. It was four nights a week, I guess. Long and the short of it was on Fridays. And then when that show went away, we were going to expand with Alan Simpson and Robert Reich.
Oh, long and the short of it. We talked about it yesterday.
That's right.
Yeah.
So Judy Starr said, well, we should really do Greater Boston 5 nights a week. And I said, okay, but I have this other idea. And I showed her the pilot. And she said, okay, let's give it a try. And that's...
You know, in light of the fact your show does well, and it should do well, and... There's a lot of talk about it. Why do you think media criticism, aside from you, has totally disappeared in this town? The Phoenix obviously folded, or the former editors, now our colleague Peter Kadzis. The Globe had an ombudsperson. They don't anymore. Why is there no appetite for this?
I once told Marty Baron, when he was still editor at the Globe, that they could do a media page every day, or every week at least, the way the business. I mean, there's especially now, when you think about mm-hmm. the enormity of what's going on in the media world, you could make it a whole beat.
You know who does a great job at it? Brian Stelter from
Brian.
CNN.
Yeah.
He
was better when he was in print, though. I just did a panel with him in Washington. He's great, but I think he's better. He had a better niche when he was in print, and they sort of forced him into this.
Yeah, well, he's got that thing I get in my email that's a list of what's going on in the media world. But I'm with you because I find it fascinating. Mm-hmm. I used to love, you know, back when Mark Jerkowitz was at the Phoenix. And
then at the Globe as the ombudsman.
He was great.
Margaret Sullivan, she's now
she was
at the
Washington Post. Yeah.
Well, even an ombudsman
did a lot of criticism.
I think the Globe would be really good at this. We used to do it. They used to do it. I mean, I remember Monica Collins a million years ago.
It's all finances.
Is that the Herald?
I mean, they eliminated everything that was extraneous.
Yeah.
I mean,
so before you tell us what you're actually going to be doing tonight.
That's why you'd like it. Yeah.
By the way, the reason you should be excited to watch tonight is not just people listening, is not just because it's the 20th anniversary and you have great respect for the work that Emily's done, but because it's live, which means there are going to be some screw-ups, which that's why you watch live.
You guys know you make a cameo appearance.
Oh, we
do?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, then I'm definitely showing up. Don't tell
us. It's not humiliating.
So wait a second. So speaking of humiliating, my favorite moment, this is probably not fair. I played it last night. Here is Emily Rooney criticizing someone you may have heard of, and then that someone responding to her criticism. Please, let's listen.
Last Week Tonight with John Oliver has languished in relative obscurity since its debut in April. But this week, an Oliver diatribe about net neutrality went viral.
Hey, f*** you, lady. Languish in relative obscurity. Relative obscurity is my middle name.
So Emily says to me, if you're not watching Greater Boston last night, turned to me on set after we played and said, you're jealous, aren't you? And I am really jealous. That was so
funny. You know what
was
funny? A lot of media critics called me after that and wanted to know if I was upset. And I said, absolutely not. Are you crazy? It was great.
Absolutely.
I actually was giving him a lot of credit for explaining net neutrality. But he just used that one little clip.
Great.
It was right.
Yeah.
I remember that show in net neutrality. I really enjoyed it because I didn't.
That's
really
how I learned. That's the only reason I understand what it is because of his
thing. He's very clever.
Very clever.
So what are we going to get tonight from 7 to 7? So and then 7:30 to 8. You can tell about that too.
We had to kind of break it down into some categories just to get our arms around it. So we're taking a look at the local media landscape and just how dramatically things have changed here locally with newspapers, television, radio, all that. We're looking at what we call a segment on crime and punishment. All the reporters, the year that I started was the year that Mike Barnicle got fired from the Boston Globe. That summer, right after Beat the Press had started. We did a lot of stuff on Beat the Press on Mike Barnicle.
Who's now a star on Morning Joe on MSNBC.
And John Carroll predicted he would be on the show that year, that he would survive. And that
he's actually great on that show, I think. But what else?
Media obsessions, some of the stories that just have, you know, just get your teeth into, you just can't let go. You know, mostly, you know, beautiful women gone missing and that kind of, but other stories that have really captured the imagination. And then we're going to end it with just kind of the triumphs, the things that really, really were important that we wouldn't have known about, like the clergy sexual abuse if it weren't for the media. Some of the great triumphant coverage episode.
And then at 7:30 is
we're
the
doing Facebook
Live. What's that going to be?
So we're going to bring some other panelists on that have
been
on
the show in the past,
and they're going to come up and join me on the stage.
Great.
And it's Facebook Live. You can ask questions. There'll be questions from the audience. And
neat.
And so 7 to 7:30 live as usual, on Channel 2, and then 7:30 to 8 Facebook Live.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Hey,
thanks,
seriously, Jim.
It's really good. It is sad that I'm more excited about her 20th
anniversary. I'm on my way to get my hair done.
You got to get your hair done for your 20th anniversary. Absolutely. Yeah. You don't want to have everything perfect.
But I'm serious. Congratulations.
Right,
you really
deserve
it. We're looking forward to
it. Emily, thank you very much. Emily Rooney joins us every Friday for her famous list. Today it was more about 20 years of Beat the Press. And you can keep up with her Friday nights right here on WGBH for Beat the Press at 7, which again, tonight is celebrating its 20th anniversary. Thank you very much, Emily Rooney.
Congrats.
Up next, Harvard Business School's Michael Norton and Allison Wood Brooks are here to talk about their research into the dark side of inside jokes. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie. And we're live at the GBH Studio at the Boston Public Library. Every month, behavioral economist Michael Norton joins us to explain ourselves to ourselves. Today, it's a look, I love this topic. Today, it's a look at humor and how inside jokes are no laughing matter because they often exclude and alienate the rest of us. Today, Michael obviously decided he couldn't handle it by himself anymore, so he brought along a colleague, Allison Wood Brooks. Allison's an assistant professor at the Harvard Business School. Allison, it's great to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
And Michael is, by the way, the Harold M. Brearley Professor of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. It's great to see you too, Michael.
How are you?
Very well. And by the way, after we discuss with them their research, we, as always, will take your calls on the topic at 877-301-8970.
By the way, since your listeners are perspicacious,
exactly.
Allison is an associate professor. She was promoted. So that's for us, that's a big
congratulations.
Deal.
Thank you
congratulations.
Very much.
Even though in the real world, assistant associate kind of mean
who
the
cares?
Same thing.
Exactly.
But for us, it's very meaningful.
Thank God you mentioned that.
I know.
By the way.
Well, really. We would have gotten calls.
I mean, it might have, that's true.
So tell us what this premise is today, Michael. What's the deal?
So we've been studying humor together for a while because we lack it entirely. No. So Allison actually is a pretty funny person. And
Mike is the only funny academic in the field, I'm pretty sure, actually.
That was a backhanded compliment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Funny academic. Anyway. And so humor is so ubiquitous in life. You know, we use it in, like, for every situation, even, like, coping with negative events. And so we've been really trying to unpack when and why we use humor, what it's good for, when it backfires. And we had this idea of studying inside jokes because, and I'll let you talk on this one, because whenever people start to whisper to each, you know, when you're at a table or at a meeting and then two people
jokes.
Start
thank
talking
you, Marjorie,
and you're wondering what they're saying and then they laugh. It annoys me, but it really annoys Allison. And so we decided to start to study these inside jokes.
Allison, start by defining what an inside joke is. What does that mean?
Absolutely. So an inside joke is any time you talk about something that there are people present that can hear you that don't understand what you're talking about, and someone in the group is going to laugh at it. Mm. Okay? So anytime you fragment a group into people who know and people who don't know, and then there's something funny that happens. So this is a sort of microcosm, a little example of a broader phenomenon that we do inside talk all the time. I could say lots of things to Mike right now that you guys wouldn't know what I'm talking about because we know each other really well, and I just met Marjorie and Jim. And inside jokes are just like an example of this.
So what you set out to find, what was the goal at the beginning of the research? What were you looking for, Allison?
So we wanted to know if these fault lines that inside jokes draw are consequential. How does it make the people on the inside feel? How does it make the people on the outside feel? And what does that do for group dynamics sort of going forward into the future?
So what did you find out there, Michael Norton?
The other thing we wanted to see was who makes them and who doesn't.
Ooh.
And also what situations prompt you to do it or not, right? So if I'm in a group of 10, what would make me feel like I want to make an inside joke with Allison? And what would make me comfortable making a joke to everybody? So we tend to find, maybe not surprisingly, that when people make inside jokes, they like each other a lot. You know, they got kind of this little moment. But everyone else really, really feels excluded. And that's the word, like socially excluded, ostracized. But the people making the inside joke don't realize it. So they think, yeah, it's fine for us to laugh, and the other people won't mind. Turns out the other people mind a lot when you do it because they feel like you're intentionally excluding them, whereas maybe we just know something from earlier and we said it randomly and we had a little laugh.
So what's the consequence for the excluded person or persons, Allison? What happens?
So because it's so hurtful, and because the people on the inside don't know that it's so hurtful, it really creates this fault line in the group and between the people in the group. They don't want to interact anymore. They like you less. They don't want to work together.
How do you feel about yourself if you're the excluded person?
Well, it's hurtful. You feel worse about yourself, and sometimes you worry, especially if you're insecure, you worry that the inside joke was about you.
Exactly.
You're like, oh, God, are they laughing at me in front of my face?
Exactly.
It's really bad.
Exactly.
This is the story of my life. I don't know. I just realized it as you were speaking. I'm the excluded one.
I mean, you guys seem to be too nice about this. I think it's really mean to do inside jokes.
Yeah.
I mean, you're really upsetting people, and you're usually laughing at the people in making a joke at the expense of somebody else who's in the group.
Well, I'd take it one step further. The one place, what you've described so far, you two, that I don't know if I agree with, and maybe I misunderstood, is one of your operating premises is those who are telling the inside joke and those who understand the inside joke are not intentionally trying to hurt people. I have been on both sides mm-hmm. of sadistic behavior where the sole purpose of the inside joke is to make someone feel excluded, mm-hmm. Either out of or been the recipient, been on the outside, mm-hmm. feel, and you know that the person is doing that inside joke thing to make you feel like an outsider.
Well, the three of us just did it to you. Break, so
but is that you didn't find that, or you that wasn't the subset that you were looking at?
So most of our data suggests that the more pervasive thing, the more common thing, is that people do it unintentionally. Mm-hmm. But certainly, if you start to scrutinize, there are instances when people are doing it on purpose.
So let's talk about the unintentional for a second. In a minute, we're going to include you in the conversation, 877-301-8970. Have you ever told inside jokes, been part of one? Have you ever been everybody's been an outsider? How did it make you feel? 877-301-8970. Let's deal with that the teller or the participants in the inside joke who are not doing it sadistically but unintentionally. When they come to realize that they've hurt somebody because they excluded them from that thing, how do they feel?
Well,
do they care?
They often don't realize.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it's unintentional in the action of it. You have this little laugh, and then you move on, and you don't realize that the people on the outside, that was quite consequential for them and made them feel really bad. They don't want to see you again, mm-hmm. And you move past it quickly.
How long-term are these? Is the impact of? I mean, I when I've been on the outside looking in, it often is like a long-term impact where you really don't at all want to, either out of embarrassment or anger or whatever. How long does it last in your research, Mike?
300 years.
it's an ongoing study.
Three generations, actually.
That's like a very Irish Catholic. It just permeates down. But I think one of the reasons, just following on Allison's point, that we don't know that we did it, is because one of the measures that we want to use in this research is if let's say that Allison and I make an inside joke right now and we start laughing, and the two of you have no idea what we're
exactly.
talking about, you will often laugh.
Because so that you can feel like you're part of it?
Well, so you look like you get the joke,
is,
right? So
hurts.
If I look around, everyone's laughing. It's the saddest thing, right? So
you think about that. How could you react? You could laugh and try to look cool to maybe some other observer, or you could be like, what are you talking right. about? And call them out on it. There's really not a great response. Mm-hmm. You can sit there quietly and feel bad. Mm-hmm.
Would you like to tell us about some of your favorite inside jokes?
I was actually thinking if I should give some examples. But I occasionally, and I am embarrassed. But you may ask me this morning, have I ever done anything I want to apologize for, mm-hmm. and have I apologized? I have, on occasion, when I was younger, done an inside joke thing to make someone feel bad as an outsider.
So have I. It was really mean.
It is
me
really
too.
Mean-spirited
okay. yeah.
in ways that... So. Whoever that person was, if I offended you, this is an ineffective yeah. apology. I hereby apologize.
And I think, by the way, that the things that prompt us to make them are particularly when we're feeling insecure.
Yes.
And when we're younger, we often just feel a little bit more insecure in who we
exactly.
are.
Exactly.
You know what's amazing
and we're
about
trying to make sure we have at least one connection in the group so that we're, cool or we fit in.
You know what my reaction to a lot of your really odd research, and now you're part of this odd circle?
Can I say angry skepticism?
I get a physical reaction in my body because it connects to something that I experienced or did.
Oh, what'd you
really
do? What'd you do? Come on, tell us.
I can't.
Oh, come on.
I really can't.
Come on.
It was about you. So, no, it wasn't. 877-301-8970. We're talking about inside jokes and the research that Allison Wood Brooks, who is no longer an assistant professor, is very sad. She's something else now. And we don't know what Michael Norton is. We just know they're both from the Harvard Business School.
But here's a great example that I used to hear a lot before we knew that we shouldn't go to many of the Vietnamese hair, nail salons because they were exploiting the workers and stuff, and you have to make sure you're not an exploitative one. So you go in and get a pedicure. Mm-hmm. And everybody's kind of sensitive about their feet. And you go in there.
Your feet are gross.
Yeah.
Feet are gross.
And you're
we
up
should
there,
be.
And they're doing the pedicure, and all of a sudden there'll be three or four of the manicurist pedicures.
This is great.
And they're speaking Vietnamese, and they start
yes.
laughing.
Yes.
And, of course, you think, they're all laughing
yes.
at my feet.
Yes.
And that's one. I think that was a very common one. When people are speaking a different language, and you don't know what they're saying?
Yes, there's a whole bit, there's a whole scene in Sex and the City, this old show,
yes!
about this very phenomenon because it's so pervasive.
And
it's
Seinfeld
so common.
Did it too, I think.
I think they did too.
At the pedicure place?
I think so.
Oh, I did not know that.
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Hey, well, that's a very common one.
Before we take calls, what I didn't ask you, is, which we often ask, is how did you construct the research? I mean, what did you do without giving us this a headache. You're nodding. So, Allison, you tell me, what'd you do to test your theories?
Sure.
Here?
So like in the nail salon when you're getting a pedicure, you want to try and have situations where some people can speak the same language and some people can't without actually speaking different languages. Mm-hmm. So in our studies, we gave people a sort of common set of knowledge by having them watch videos. And they watch the video, and then they can joke about it afterwards. And the other people didn't see that video. They have no idea what they're talking about. And then we measure things like, how did you feel? How did the outsiders feel, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay, let's take some calls, Marjorie. 877-301-8970. We have Allison Wood Brooks and Michael Norton with us here at our studio at the Boston Public Library.
Gigi in the car. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Gigi.
Hey there. Hi. Really enjoy your show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I love all your subjects. They're very varied, and this one hits close home to me because I endured this for about 9 months at a very toxic job.
Oh,
tell
no.
Us.
It's definitely, yeah. It's a passive-aggressive tool that people use.
Well, tell us what happened, as much as you're comfortable, at least there, Gigi, if you would.
Well, I was in a job that a new person had come in to the supervisor, and she wanted to get rid of me, and I actually had somebody say to me, she's gaslighting you. I said, I don't know what that is.
Ooh.
So sure enough, she's gaslighting me and getting a couple of people on the staff to, you know, joke, and they were always together, and they would always tell these little funny, they would have these funny little things, and they'd laugh, or they'd do something that was, they would do something, in other words, that I wouldn't know anything about because I wasn't there as often as they were because I was part-time.
So what did it do to you? So, how did it feel to you?
Well, I mean, you definitely feel ostracized. I mean, if I tell an inside joke and then I'll say, oh, that was funny because of this, and I'll explain it. But there was none of that. They just all laughed, and they would look across the table at each other and exchange these glances. And it was clear to me that they didn't want me to be a part of that. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's awful.
Gigi, can I ask you a question? Were they your peers in the organization, lower status than you or higher status?
There were two people that were the same status as me and the supervisor who was the one that was instigating all of this.
Oh, so.
And it was a church.
Oh my God.
That's great.
I hear you guys talk about church all the time, and I'm thinking, oh God, I don't want to call in. I have so much to say.
Well, you did. Gigi, you're great.
That
thank you
great
for
call.
Sharing the story. We really appreciate
supervisor
it.
Supervisor was like a mother superior or something.
No, we hadn't talked about your question, Allison, about where they are in the hierarchy of your. That also has a huge impact.
A lot of it, we think, is about jockeying for status, that you're more likely to do this, to tell inside jokes and want to feel together with people who are your peers or higher, and you're happy to exclude people who are lower status, which is just, like, even more despicable, mm-hmm. right? Like,
well,
it's just awful.
I remember at the Boston Herald, which is used to be, before newspapers shrunk, a pretty big newsroom, and there was one guy that we all thought was going to come in and start shooting one day. You know, he was just that person that you thought... And we used to be terrible talking about him.
Oh.
It was awful. It's wondering.
Wait, in front of him?
No, behind.
Well, that's not
his
an
back.
Inside joke then. If he doesn't
well,
know that you're doing
sort
it.
Sort of. He's only 10 feet away from you. I don't know.
If he could see you laughing, I think.
Is that an inside joke? Maybe it's not. If he's like 10 feet away,
he has to know.
He has to know.
There has
okay.
to be something observable.
Okay. So you mean it wasn't horrible of us to be all talking about this guy that we thought he was like a serial killer? That's pretty bad.
If he's not there, then it's gossip, right?
Okay.
So that's sort of the distinction between... inside jokes are like gossiping in front of someone.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay.
A little bit.
All right.
Both are terrible, just to
both
be clear.
Both are terrible. Yeah. No, I'm guilty of them both.
Yes.
Let's go to Mia from Hingham. Hi, Mia.
Hi, Mia. Maya?
Oh, hi.
How do you say
hello,
your first
hello.
Name?
Yes.
Mia?
Hi. Yes, oh. Mia? Hello.
Mia, hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, hi, Mia. How are you? It's like
hi,
a who's on first
okay.
thing here. Go ahead. You're on the show. Thank you for calling. Yeah. What's up?
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I was thinking about the topic of inside jokes, and I was sort of curious if y'all had any thoughts on, like, internet memes, because I'm a 20-something, and I feel like that's something that I deal with on a, like, pretty day-to-day basis, and I kind of feel like internet memes are sort of, like, wider-scale inside jokes, and I don't know if I've ever, like, been in a situation where those have been used, like, maliciously in, like, a smaller scale, but I don't know. I was just sort of curious if you had any like constructive thoughts in it. It's something that I definitely like.
Don't go away. It's a very interesting question. I like, hear the response.
I first just like the idea that people over the age of 30 don't know what internet memes
are. We were all saying, that's what I wanted to say. That's what I wanted to say to Mia. We are all over 30.
What's the internet?
I don't know. So what's your reaction to that? No, they're kidding, I hope.
Yes.
What's your reaction to her observation there?
I think that people do internet memes and also internet communities. If you've ever been on, you know, Reddit or any of those things, they absolutely develop their own vocabulary, their own, literally their own words and images and things like that. You can think of like far right wing ones. It's a whole other vocabulary. And the jokes are also completely different. They're not typically using them to get somebody else directly as opposed to bond with each other. So memes, I think, if you deliberately like showed one on your phone in a meeting and you knew that only two other people were under the age of 30, for example, and everyone else wouldn't get it, then it would be a little bit closer because I'm deliberately showing you something that you'll think is funny and no one else will get. I wouldn't call it exactly an inside joke.
But even if the intention is not to exclude, which seems to be the criterion that you're selecting, if the consequence of the attempt just to bond is to exclude, then it's the same bottom line. No?
Yeah, so a lot of weird dynamics arise when you talk about conversation in groups versus one-on-one, and social media is like the ultimate example of a giant group conversation where all of these sort of fragmenting dynamics, things that we do to divide up groups, are particularly pervasive. And
Mia, that was a great question. Thank you very much for calling it in.
Let's go to Carrie in Providence. Hi, Carrie.
Hello, Carrie.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I love this subject because I am a big fan of humor, so I'm sure most of you are. But my husband and I are both jokers, and we have a lot of inside jokes. Like, we'll hear a word, and we'll, like, relate it to an experience or something, and we'll say, whisper to each other something. Or, like, for instance, if anyone ever says anything about being gay, we'll both whisper to each other, not that there's anything wrong with that. And I've never really thought until I heard this conversation about the fact that I may be making other people feel excluded, and unintentionally, of course, but...
So what do you think about that, Allison?
We're always happy to guilt trip people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, listen, we just got an email...
Carrie, thanks. That was a good point.
From Joy, who says something similar to what Carrie said, that she says, I think I've done it if I'm in a group I don't know well and I want to feel close to the one person I do know, not necessarily to hurt the other people, but to feel close to that person that she shares a joke with. So what do you make of that?
Yeah, I think of these examples where... this is super random, but sometimes you'll be in a group and something happens and suddenly everyone shouts a word. Like, suddenly everyone says, Bermuda! And they all laugh, you know? And you're like, what's that all about? You know? So you're... And they're not doing it on purpose at all. It's just something... They took a trip there, whatever it might be, and now they're reflecting on it. And so I think often in groups, the intentionality isn't there.
Yeah.
But now I'm feeling... I could have felt equally close with everyone, and now just like that, I'm feeling completely far from everyone. And I do think that people are often then trying to use it to get back in.
Yeah.
In a sense. Like, well, at least they have one thing in common with that guy. Let me see if I can yell, you know, New Hampshire or something and see if we can bond,
you know, Allison,
bond on that.
And also, I'm thinking back to what you said a few minutes ago, getting back to Marjorie's question, when have I been in this situation? I've been in the situation where I've been the outsider and tried to play along and been in abject panic that I was going to be challenged.
Yes.
That, you know, because if sadism was the motivating factor, and you don't always know, and then you decide to play along by laughing, even though you have no idea what's going on, the humiliation becomes on steroids.
Oh, yeah.
If they actually turn to you and say, do you know what you're laughing? Do you know who? Oh, my God.
And by the way, this offers an incredible opportunity for people to be very kind and smooth, too. So those who are aware that an inside joke has been made, you can also turn to the people on the outside and say, I'm sorry, this is so awkward. Let me explain to you. Bermuda, we all went on a trip together. It was really fun, and we like remembering about it. And, and then you can like bring them along for the journey instead of calling them out and say, like, Jim, why are you laughing?
Listen to this one from Eva. I'm a Spanish medical interpreter in a hospital, and I wanted to mention another situation where people are left out of the conversation, which is when doctors speak in English but then tell the interpreter, don't tell her that to the patient. And she said, yeah, so then they'll make some terrible remark, like, why couldn't the person who's been here for 10 years learn English or something like that? And, of course, they say, don't say that. So that's really horrible.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. They're making fun of you. Never mind your feet. They got your whole body there, and they're making fun of you in front of, among each other. Oh, my God. Eva, that was a great one. Thank
this
you.
This whole conversation's upsetting me. Fred and Hull, can you make it worse? Hi, Fred.
Hey there. I'll do my best.
Okay, thank
you. This is, I love your show, by the way. Listen every day. Got my mom involved.
Oh, thank you very much.
What's up?
the example that I see, you know, it happens a lot. And I think it's just low-grade bullying more than anything else.
It is.
And
yeah.
Great point.
You know, from that sense, there's, if you listen to, like, Big Bang Theory, you know, we're all a little nerdy at heart, right? So we can all sympathize on the nerd side. And there's all kinds of examples of Leonard and Sheldon getting bullied and from their childhood. And then there's Penny, who is clearly part of the cheerleading squad, and she had no idea that she was doing the bullying. And she would just not remember. And I think a lot of people that tell these inside jokes, get back to them in 10 years, Michael, and see what they say about whether they remembered it.
That's great. Hey, Fred, thank you for the call. By the way, in the case where it's intentional, unlike what you got, bullying is a perfect, I think it's
bullying.
A perfect description.
It is bullying. So have you guys either done this, been telling inside
lives?
Jokes in a bullying way?
To each other.
Yeah. To each other, you probably have, to each other. But, I mean, don't you think about when you were little? I mean, I think of things I did when I was little.
Yeah.
Like
what?
Terrible.
What'd you do? Give one example.
Well,
because you
is
were a
really
cheerleader,
awful.
Co-captain.
No, this is when I was about 11. This was really mean. I had an older friend who was, you know, developed, as we used to say in those days.
Ooh.
And my younger friend who was not. Ooh. And the older friend and I kept calling her up on the phone and said, can we please speak to Mr. Pancake Man?
That's not an inside
joke. It
was
terrible.
That's just sadistic.
It's bullying.
Yeah, that's just evil.
It is.
It was evil. It's terrible. It's awful. It was awful. And she told it to me years later because the woman that I called Mr. Pancake Man became my best friend. And she mentioned that. I know. It was terrible.
No, we're terrible people, too. Mm-hmm. I have an identical twin sister. And so we're so close and our brains work in the same way that you really have to stop yourself from making inside talk or inside jokes in front of other people because it's like you do speak your own language.
Parenting, I think, is one, too, where parents hanging out with non-parents, parents have their own language about various products that might happen. And so you could say something like Desitin. And parents might laugh or something like
A&D.
That.
Yeah,
you know, and so everyone else is, what the heck are we talking about?
We have time for another couple of calls.
Come on, I told a terrible one about Mr. Pancake Man. You guys must have a terrible one.
What are you looking at me for?
Because I know you do.
I don't. No, what? I don't.
No,
by the way, yours are so benign, it's pathetic.
Yeah, Jim's been on the outside.
That was really
devastating. I've been on the inside, too.
At least Mrs. Pancake would have been nicer.
She called it 25 times. She kept picking up the phone.
Let me tell you, were really a wild and crazy kid.
It was awful.
Let's go to Bradley in Falmouth. You're on with Michael Norton and Allison Wood Brooks from Harvard Business School, and we're talking about inside jokes. Hey there, Bradley.
Good afternoon. This is Mr. Pancake Man himself.
Hi, Kevin.
What's up, Brad? It's Bradley.
Oh, it's Bradley. Whoops.
Close enough.
Sorry.
Go ahead. Hi.
It's okay. No, quick question. I mean, do you find it that it's on more on the female side or on the male side?
Great question.
Great question. Yeah.
For the workplace, I work for a healthcare agency, and I find that a lot of the women in the office, because I am a male, there's a lot of that chitter chatter in the office, and there's a lot of inside jokes. So, yeah, do you think it's on the male or female side?
So we haven't looked at gender specifically in our research, and I can imagine the opposite hypothesis, too, where men can do this very, like, boys club type of talk. Anytime you guys talk about sports. Actually, mm-hmm. feels like inside jokey, and you're on the outside, women are on the outside.
But there is a mean girls thing here, too.
Totally.
You know, so maybe both sexes,
that was a great
genders
movie.
Do it.
I'm wondering if Bradley is being the victim of this because he's a man or because he's Bradley. And we don't really know.
Bradley,
if you want to fight back,
well,
he
said he was Mr. Pancake Man. And nobody wants to work with that guy.
How about it, Bradley?
Wow,
exactly. Don't worry, Michael won't be on the show again now that we have Allison.
Allison Wood Brooks will be taking over.
Bradley, thank you. We have time for one more, Marjorie.
Now,
you want to take it?
Now it's Kevin in the car.
Oh, it is Kevin. Hi, Kevin in the car.
How are you guys?
Great.
Excellent.
Love the show, by the way. Listen to you guys every day.
Thank you.
I travel over here every day, 5 days a week.
Thank you.
The company I last worked for, I worked for about 4 years, very prominent company in New York, and that was the culture. The entire culture in the company was inside jokes. It didn't matter if it was in a one-on-one, in two managers, one employee going over your performance. If it was in 20 people in the room, we had two shifts. Just to give you a little backstory, we had two shifts. We all did the same job, taking care of pumps, very high-end equipment, and one team would be called the project team, and we weren't in on that. That was supposed to be for the smart guys, and all the managers were in on it. They all would speak the same lingo. They all knew what that meant. They were all trying to say, guys, we're not trying to build silos here. We're all trying to get along. But the entire company was based on inside jokes.
Kevin, I wish you could see the knowing nods from Allison and Michael as you are speaking. You obviously have encountered that.
Oh,
kind
man.
Of
I mean, if jargon is any indicator of inside talk or inside jokes, like, man, academics are so good at dry jargon that no one understands.
I mean, the Harvard Business School is perfect, but other schools probably
that's
would
right.
have.
We're flawless.
It's dog-eat-dog in that academic world. That's what I hear. Vicious. Yeah. Vicious. Mm-hmm. Especially at the cocktail parties. Most vicious of all. That's what I understand, Jim.
Oh.
Okay. I can't believe you called that young woman.
Isn't that terrible?
Call her Mrs. Pancake.
25
Pancake
times.
Marjorie. Over and over and over again. It was terrible.
Horrible.
It was terrible. I'm going to have to call this afternoon and apologize yet again.
You should.
Okay.
Allison, it's great to meet you.
Nice
and
to
Michael,
meet you.
Michael, it's great to see you as always. Thanks to both of you.
Allison Wood Brooks is an assistant professor at the Harvard Business School. Michael Norton is the Harold M. Brealey Professor of Business Administration, also at Harvard Business School. His latest book is Happy Money, The Science of Happier Spending. Allison and Michael, thank you very much. This was really fun. Coming up, also really fun, playwright and public intellectual Ryan Landry will tell us whether Baby, It's Cold Outside, the Christmas classic, must be banished forever. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, joined by a very dashing-looking Ryan Landry, I should say, today, for another episode of You Get the Picture. It's his recurring segment of social observations. Ryan Landry is a playwright, lyricist, actor, founder of the Gold Dust Orphans Theatrical Company. Their latest is Nightmare on Elm Street. They just got a spectacular review in the Boston Globe. Nice to see you, Ryan Landry.
It's good to see you, too, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, too. And we're only 14 days away from coming to see
your spectacular
Christmas.
Yes, we are.
Whole team.
We're excited.
The whole team is going to come.
Countdown to horror.
So let's start with a song, since you have an awful lot of songs in your productions. I just mentioned... and we should probably play a little bit of the sound. Baby, It's Cold Outside, a Christmas classic, which has now come under criticism because people think it's kind of a sexual predator going after
I
it.
Don't...
Well, let's play it first. Wait. For those who don't know, this is the original we're going to play from 1949.
Yep.
It's from Neptune's Daughter, and it was starring Esther Williams and Ricardo Montalban. Here it is.
The neighbor's my
But baby, it's bad out there.
Say, what's in this drink?
No cabs to be had out there.
I wish I knew how.
Your eyes are like stars
to
right
break
now.
Break this spell.
I'll take your hat. Your hair looks swell.
I ought to say no, no, no,
Mind
sir.
If I move in closer?
At least I'm gonna say that I tried.
What's the sense of hurting my pride?
I really can't
Oh, baby,
stay.
Don't hold out, baby.
Oh, but it's cold outside.
Okay, banished forever, Ryan? Yes or no?
Look at his
no,
face.
No, absolutely not. What are you talking? What are we talking about?
I'll tell you
these
what we're
days.
Talking about. Say, what's in this drink? I mean, no,
that she's
it
joking
might have been
around.
Vodka in the drink.
She's joking.
Or gin in the drink.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
yeah.
Wait, is this because you don't think anything should be banned? Is that a fair assumption?
Are the lyrics like, "Do you have a key to these handcuffs?" No.
Don't lock me in the basement.
Yeah, please don't lock me in the basement with the rats. No, those are not the lyrics.
I thought this story was about a period of time. This is written in the 1940s, as you point out.
49.
Where good girls were not supposed to want to get down and dirty or roll around.
If she had to put up this idea of like, oh, no.
And yeah, her voice does not sound like
she plans on opening that door.
So how do you feel about this, since I believe you're the only woman on this panel at the moment? So what's the answer to that?
I just told you. I mean, the only thing you could possibly think was objectionable here, I think, is what's in this drink, meaning that somehow he spiked the drink a la Cosby or something. But I see this. When you look at all the lyrics, and she's worried about what her mother's going to think and her father's going to think and the maintenance. So I think it's about being out late with a guy in 1949.
And how she's going to be talked about the next day.
Yes, when you're not supposed to, because it seems to me she wants to stay.
You know, by the way, let me just be clear about this. This is not one of these talk radio topics.
Ricardo Montalban.
I love Ricardo Montalban.
Who would not want to stay?
Jim would want to stay with Ricardo Montalban.
Maybe I would. Maybe I wouldn't.
Exactly.
But, you know, this is not one of these phony talk radio topics where there's one station in Omaha abandoned. A ton of radio stations are not permitting this Christmas call. Look at the look on your face. Is this because you didn't answer my question? You don't think anything should be censored, do you, or do you?
I don't believe in censorship.
I knew that.
No,
well, that's fine.
Not.
I admire your position.
I absolutely do not.
So how about you, Jim?
Well, I'm embarrassed now because I am a little troubled by this, I have to say. Mm-hmm. But after the two of you, particularly you, because I assumed Ryan's position would be what it was. Now I'm embarrassed to say what I thought 10 minutes ago. So the answer is I'm rethinking my position. Is that fair enough or no?
I think it's fair enough.
I think that's very there's a piece written. It doesn't say who wrote this.
That says what?
Feminist woman is all it says. She says, it is not a song about rape. It's a song about the desires even good girls have.
Well, that's essentially what Ryan is saying. No?
Well, that's my big problem with a lot of this stuff is for some people, I think it's really the destruction of romance, of sex. It's like the erasure of sex. And I think that, like, if that's the kind of world these people want, well, they're in for a big surprise because it's a pretty ugly, boring world.
Yeah. And think of those times when you were, like, 22 and the blizzard was your excuse. How could you possibly come home?
I didn't need a blizzard for an excuse.
Well, this is presuming you were still living at home with mom and dad. You didn't want to upset anybody.
Oh, my God. I snuck him in through the window.
I bet you did.
All right. Well, let's play you another song.
Well, by the way, if he doesn't think that one's objectionable, he's really going to ridicule us for this one. Take it away.
This is a famed song from Kiss the Girl from The Little Mermaid, which I've seen about 9,000 times. Here you are. Here's the song.
There you see her, sitting there across the way. She don't got a lot to say, but there's something about her. And you don't know why, but you're dying to try. You wanna kiss the girl.
Did you hear something?
Yes, you want her.
I love this song.
Do we have to listen to the whole
thing?
Yeah,
I love this song.
Are you
kidding?
Come
on. Talk about romance.
As I recall, the Little Mermaid and the Prince were in a rowboat at this time, and she was really anxious for him to kiss
her. As you recall, you said you watched it 80,000
times. I did, but it was a while back when my kids were little. But I think that was the scene. She was in a rowboat, and they're rowing, and she wants him to kiss her because then she'll get her voice back.
Yeah.
So I don't get the objection to this either.
I don't either. You know what I find so offensive about that song?
What?
That really crappy Maurice Chevalier impersonation.
Thank heaven.
Yeah.
For little girls. Is that what we're talking about?
No, yours is even more offensive.
Well, talk about a song that would be banished.
Gigi. Yeah. That's a very good point. For those who don't remember Gigi with Leslie Caron and Maurice Chevalier, he's an older guy who's like... Was he hitting on Gigi? I can't remember.
No,
I haven't seen that in like 8 years.
Louis Jordan.
Once again, absolutely. Listen.
Can you imagine having Ricardo Montalban and Louis Jordan in the same room
Ricardo Montalban doing those commercials called Doba.
Yeah, that's right.
Fine.
Okay.
No, wait a second. What were you saying there, though? Gigi. Oh, Maurice Chevalier.
Maurice Chevalier was one of those, bemused smiles on his face as he walks slowly through the park in Paris, thinking about the loves of his young life. And he's basically a narration type thing with Gigi.
Not anymore.
He's a pedophile now.
Do you know, by the way,
now he's
we should say the reason we talked about Little
Everyone's
Mermaid
a pedophile.
You didn't get in Is Princeton where you didn't get in? Is that where you didn't get in?
Yes, I was devastated.
Okay, fine. So I didn't mean to rub it in. But
devastated.
You didn't get into Princeton?
No, I did not.
Why? She got into Smith and Stanford,
though. My excuse was that they didn't let many women in there.
There were very few women
then.
They just started doing women.
That's my excuse. But let me tell you, I never got over it.
But before that, by the way, the a cappella group at Princeton stopped singing.
Yeah, they did.
Kiss That Girl because of the complaints about...
Well, it's a crappy song.
Well, yeah, it's not because it was a crappy song. It was because of the alleged sexism or something. But, you know,
I don't think Walt Disney would have liked The Little Mermaid.
Why? Because it's too sweet?
I don't think he would have thought it was up to snuff. I really don't. No, I mean, if you look at the great masterpieces.
Oh, yeah?
You know,
Dumbo.
When he was alive. Beautiful.
Dumbo.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but Dumbo
there's a lot of racism. And there is racism.
In Dumbo.
This they are right about. Don't make a face at me, Ryan Landry.
Oh,
when they have those
brother.
Faceless black workers kind of I mean, that is a little problematic.
How about Bambi?
They were faceless. Yeah, but it was a play on silhouettes. Did you really look at it, or are you just like saying...
I did actually look. I had kids who were watching it like 24/7. The one place where I know we'll agree, Marjorie and I did about 42 shows on this in our former life on the... Do you remember, was it Amherst that banned West Side Story?
That's right.
Because it was racist?
That was racist.
That put me over...
Yeah. The Jets and the Sharks. I think we can all agree the best Disney film ever made, of course, is none other than Secretariat, which I've seen.
There's no the erasing of history will do us no good. It will only come back to bite us in the arse. Can I say arse?
No, you can't. Speaking of Secretariat and speaking of PC-icity, which we were talking about, PETA is on a new campaign. And while people like to ridicule PETA, I should say they are actually one of the more effective advocacy groups. They win their battles. I'm not sure.
I'm all for animal rights in every way. Absolutely.
You have a live dog in that play we just saw. It's carried around for 2 hours.
My little love bug.
What? But is that not cruel?
Oh, brother, get off of it.
Okay, fine. Now,
why is everyone so offended by everything? Everyone's annoyed by things. It's getting me annoyed.
Yes. Let's see if you're annoyed by this.
Can we have some fun here?
No, here's how we're going to have fun.
I think
you'd be fine with this. PETA wants to ban animal language. Now, let me get your sense on this here, Ryan Landry.
Yeah.
They don't like kill two birds with one stone. I'm sure you understand why. They would prefer to feed two birds with one scone. What do you think? Why are they people laughing? I'm not done with this. They hate beat a dead horse, and they, of course, would prefer to replace with feed a fed horse. What do you think about that?
I think these people are bored and have too much time on their hands.
Uh-huh. How about you, Marjorie?
Somebody actually agreed with you.
From our studio audience.
Bring home the bagels. And they want you to say
instead of bring home the bacon.
I'm not sure if that's going to prevent people from eating pigs.
By the way, the best part of this is the reaction on Twitter to this effort to ban anti-animal language. Here is Reese, somebody who tweeted, "Surely you have bigger fish to fry than this." Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And John, somebody, Dana, tweeted, "I smell a rat." What do you think of that there? Thank you very much. Does that make you happy?
I think the whole idea of, it's, for instance, like the war on drugs. That is a ridiculous war.
Ridiculous.
Because people are always going to use drugs.
Exactly.
And this seems to be a war on language, and I just think that it's just a dead-end road. I understand that people have been hurt by words, and I understand that words are powerful, but I also understand that we're human beings, and I think that that is being discounted, and it's all about... control. This is micromanaging other people. And when you talk about that, you might as well be living in a society that is completely fascist, and I am not for it.
You know, where are you? By the way, Marjorie is pro-drug.
We should ask him the Kevin Hart story.
Why don't you ask him? You're standing right
here.
Yeah.
Kevin Hart, comedian.
You're a gay guy.
Oh, you just outed me, Marjorie. No one knew from the sound of my voice.
No one knew.
Okay,
but we had a discussion early on. Kevin Hart has said he's not going to be in the Oscars.
Yeah, well, he sucks anyway.
I am with you.
I'm so glad you said that. Yeah. I don't think he's funny either.
If I was in charge of that, I'd be like, here's your pink slip or whatever you call it, you know, which probably he wears one. But, I just want to let you know, it's not because you're anti-gay language. It's just because you really suck as a comedian.
Yeah.
So
I never
lost.
Found him funny either.
Well, he said some tough things, including back in 2011, he said something like, I'm paraphrasing now, that if his little son were to play with his little daughter's dollhouse, he'd... he'd scream and yell at the kid because he doesn't want to have a gay son. So it was pretty, you know, it's homophobic stuff. But we had an interesting divide among our gay listeners, some of whom thought he should be out of there because he's a homophobe, and some who said, hey, you know what? We got bigger fish to fry.
It was a different time. Was there a thesis?
It was and people can evolve.
So if he was funny, would you be forgiving?
I think people can evolve when their paycheck goes up $2 million.
So should he get thrown out of the Oscars? Or
yeah, because he stinks.
Okay, because he stinks. But if he didn't stink?
Well, if he didn't stink, I wouldn't care really that much. Because those things don't bother me. I think they're I don't think they're hilarious because they're funny. I think it's hilarious that people care so much.
Okay, all right.
I think we should care about bigger things.
You are a libertarian when it comes to language.
I believe you should not be policed with your language.
Okay.
Are you a libertarian to the point?
Biggest, creepy, most horrible people, Donald Trump, for instance, who, if I remember correctly, I was on the show a couple of years ago with Jim, and just the mention of Donald Trump and saying I didn't like him, you were like saying, oh, don't, the Secret Service will be coming. And now the stuff you say about that clown is worse than what I've ever said. So
well,
finally you've come around.
Why are you looking at her when you're talking about me?
Oh, I'm going to look at you
thank you very much.
There you go.
Where are you? Speaking of Mr. Libertarian, wow. Marjorie is of the Portugal model, legalize all drugs, not for, because they advocate public health over...
Well, here's a very good reason.
And by the way, Shalene Title, who's one of the five members of the Cannabis Control Commission, shares your perspective.
Because one of the things that's killing... The big killer now in the opioid epidemic is fentanyl. Now, if you didn't have to buy opioids on the street, you wouldn't have fentanyl in your opioids and you wouldn't be dying. So I think it's... what Portugal has done is they put the money... taken it out of the prisons, taken it out of the prosecutions, and put it into treatment. And I think it would be a good thing to do right here in the United States.
I think most of the money that we're spending on a lot of these things could be much better spent on watching our young people grow, not the minutia of bureaucracy of education, but actually connecting with the kids and making them know that just because these counselors are not their family members, they still care about the kids and want and lead them through that very, very dark hallway of their life before they reach the point of graduating high school. I think that section of a person's life is the most important from 10 to about 18.
I think that's a great
point. And I think that money could be spent on a personal counselor for every damn kid in the world compared to the money we're spending on stupid, stupid things to really... That's going to help the future, and there won't be a war on drugs because people won't be... They'll know they're loved, and that's really what matters. People need to be just treated kindly, and it's an answer to a lot of problems.
Okay,
so speaking of wasting our time on things, I have heard from a very reliable source that you wrote an email to an unnamed person saying that instead of calling this segment every 2 weeks with you, with Ryan Landry, you get the picture. It should only be called You Get the Picture.
Yeah.
Now, is that true?
Yeah, because it's too friggin' long.
Okay.
I mean,
okay, well, that's
it's like my nose.
Well, thank
it
you.
It arrives three
Mine
days
too.
Before
I
you go, can I read something if you don't mind? It happens to be a...
I do mind, but
thank
go ahead.
You. It's about a nightmare on Elf Street.
Oh, good.
But this is also the time of year. This would be from the Boston Globe. When Ryan Landry, that'd be you, by the way, and the Gold Dust Orphans, that would be your band of Murray pranksters or whatever they are over there,
brother,
can be relied on to counteract that surfeit, is that how you say that word?
Surfeit?
Surfeit, whatever it is, of sugary sentiment by teeing up a brand new holiday-themed musical parody written by Landry that is spiked with more than a little Murray malice. Neither Landry nor his orphans have ever had any difficulty choosing which side of the naughty or nice line to stand on. So a success, this production. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, and you know what's so funny?
What?
The night that Donna Coyne, who's the reviewer for the Boston Globe, came, my mother died that day.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Oh, no, don't be sorry. She was a horrible woman. No, I hardly knew her. I was raised by my aunt and uncle, but she was a horrible woman. But I spent my entire life always feeling that I had to prove myself, that I would be wanted, that I had something to offer because of this situation that happened when I was a baby. And
I didn't feel anything when I heard that my mother died. But when I read the end of Don's review, where he said that I had said it to the audience, I thank you for giving me this wonderful life. God bless you. I started bawling.
Oh, my God.
In
oh
my dressing
God.
Room. And they had to come carry me out of there. I was in such a state of emotion from a review. Can you imagine?
Well, that is really a beautiful last paragraph to his story. He's really talented, not to mention his son who writes the operas.
Just won a MacArthur Prize, too, the kid.
Yeah, he did?
Yeah, he's unbelievably talented. And Donald Coyne is pretty talented, too. It's a beautiful ending.
It is a beautiful ending. And I have to say, I forced my next-door neighbors in Cambridge, who didn't want to go the other night because they wanted to do
low
something.
Low-grade bullying.
I did force them. I said, trust me, they were ready to hate the whole thing. And they awoke me at 11 o'clock because I'm usually asleep by about 3 hours by then.
You're
awakened, whatever I was. To say it was one of the most fun nights of their life. So you've made a lot of people happy. We are coming on the 21st for the BPR Christmas party.
Yeah.
Ryan Landry, we'll see you soon. Thanks
love
so much
you
for
kids.
Being here. Love you, too.
Oh, several emailers are pointing out, and they're right, that they didn't stop, the a cappella group at Princeton did not stop singing it just because it was the Little Mermaid song and making him.
Why did they stop?
Because they were taking people out of the audience. And having them kiss on stage.
Oh.
That was the thing that got them
fine.
Upset.
I have no problem
okay.
with that either.
Okay. Anyway.
Nice to see you, Ryan.
Ryan
nice
Landry,
to see
thank you.
You
very much. Ryan joins us regularly for With Ryan Landry.
I
you
kiss
get the
people
picture.
Every day.
He's a playwright, lyricist, actor, founder of the Gold Dust Orphans Theatrical Company. You can see their original production, and it's great. Donald Coyne has just said so. We're going to go ourselves in a couple of...
we're sold out tomorrow, but come tonight. Yeah.
Great.
A Nightmare on Elm Street, on stage now through December 23rd at Machine Night Club. To learn more about it, go to brownpapertickets.com.
Brownpapertickets.com.
Yes. Up next, Neil deGrasse Tyson's having a Me Too moment, too. Oh, my God. Callie Crossy joins for that and more. Next on 89.7 WGBH, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Mind if I move in closer?
At least I'm going to say that I tried.
What's the sense of hurting my pride?
I really can't stay.
Oh, baby, don't hold out, baby.
Oh, it's cold outside.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us, as she does every Friday, is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. And I guess that would mean it is Callie Crossley, who, by the way, is not only host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley and Basic Black, will be a panelist on the 20th anniversary show of Beat the Press tonight. Congratulations to you, too.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it'll be interesting.
We're very excited.
Yeah. So, Deval Patrick has said he's not going to run for president. Yeah. I am really disappointed because I could see him in a debate with Trump doing very well. But I don't know. What do you think?
I could definitely see that. I mean, he's got the skills to, you know, comport himself in a way that I think would make a lot of people be interested in him. I, however, think that the number one thing that was not going to make it possible is that nobody, I don't care, this country is not ready for another black person to be and a black man to be president, period. So that was going to be an uphill battle he'd have to climb, even though I think he has some other skills and to offer, other skills and talents to offer.
But did you think America was ready for a black president in 2008? I did not.
No, but I'm saying, but after Barack Obama and all of this chaos we're in now, I can tell you that's not happening. That is just not happening. So, you know... Listen, he's got a tough skin, so he could take it if he had to be out there on the campaign trail. But even he said it's gotten so mean and nasty that somebody who could raise money, somebody who could, you know, do what you said, you know, be hold his own in any kind of situation and be unflappable in a way that you remember. I don't know if you remember, but back in the day when they were arguing about whether or not when Obama was trying to push through Merrick Garland, I suggested he push through Deval Patrick, even though I knew he wasn't interested, because I thought it would just be great to hear him just combat those people who would be questioning him, and that he would just be unflappable in that situation, I think, from
so
my
you
perspective.
Think, so you think it's because of that Obama begot Trump, or because we have to wait 25 years before another black guy elected? Or
I
what?
Just don't think that's the time for another black person running for president. It's going to be a while. And, you know, maybe I'm negative nanny, but I don't think so.
But because why, though?
Well, because I think Obama was a perfect storm and a unique person, and I just don't think the nation's ready.
I have to say, one thing to the positive side of Val Patrick's resume. He's one of the best campaigners I've ever seen.
Well,
in
that's
my life.
It. Yeah. Well,
he is really one-on-one and speechifying.
Oh, I've
God,
said
really good.
I'm with you. I don't disagree. I know.
But you know, I've said this a million times. To me, he gave a better campaign speech than Obama because he did the full range. Mm. I remember seeing him down in New Bedford. I've said this a million times, where everybody was like crying listening to him. And he's really...
Well, you know, and you're right about that. The speech that I now wish I could, you know, quote from that I remember is when we were at the point, when the state was at the point of having to take in some of those unaccompanied minors. And their people were really mad about it. And he did his I don't know if it was a speech or his comments, his formal comments were just stunning. I mean, he did not back away from it. He stood up to it. He said, you know, this is a moral issue. This is where we ought to be. This is why, blah, blah, blah. It was powerful. And I think that so many people are ducking and dodging any kind of tough issue. He went right for it and said, this is what I'm doing, and I'm doing it, and here's why. You know.
So, Kelly, yesterday on the show, Marjorie and I spent about 40 minutes talking about the despicable Jeffrey Epstein. The despicable Les Moonves, Harvey Weinstein, and it not only is it easy to believe, but easy to dislike and condemn. Somebody who doesn't fall into that latter category is probably one of the most admired people in America, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who was actually at GBH, as recently as a month ago. Tell us what has befallen him and what his response is, if you would.
Well, BuzzFeed, which is a website some people may know, and they have a very strong investigative team. They completed an investigation they've been working on for more than a year and followed up. There was a woman who accused Neil deGrasse Tyson of abuse years ago.
Were students, right? Grad students?
Yeah, they were grad students together. One of two black students at, I need to look and see where the University of Texas, Austin, I think that's where it is. And in any case, they, you know, became good friends, she thought. And then, according to her, he took advantage of that, and she uses the terminology rape. She said it, then she sort of had a break. Had a lot of tragedies befall her, dissolution of her marriage that came later, blah, blah, blah. And so it was easier for people to say, well, she's, we don't know about her, you know, as a witness. And nobody else was saying anything. Well, now three other women have come forward. One of them most recently was a woman that was driving him. She's a young woman, and she knew she was getting into driving him. She knew that was not the gig she wanted. She was interested in other professional work in science, but thought this is a way to get to know him.
Ashley Watson.
And, you know, what happened to her, and she realized, wait a minute, you know, this is beginning to ring true from what I heard before. Then a couple of other women have come forward, so now there's four women with credible accusations and backed up by the kind of investigation that BuzzFeed has done.
You know what particularly struck me as upsetting here was that this woman met Tyson's mother and wife and son, and he met her father, her sister, and her fiancé. So the usual dehumanizing thing that goes on in these situations... Mm-hmm. Well, she was at least humanized in terms of family, and she met his family, and it apparently didn't matter. You know?
Well, but you know, how many of the experts have told us now over and over again that these things happen, particularly rape, when people you know, not strangers, that's a myth, that it's, you know, the real thing that's happening is someone close to you or someone who knows you. Which makes it doubly shocking, which is why, if I'm going to go back to some of these college campus situations where these young women are going to class, they're interacting with these young men in social situations, and they come forward, I you know, with rare exception, want to believe them because, you know, they're right there with them every day, and this is, you know, it's close proximity, and more often than not, they've proven to be right.
Also, correct me if I'm wrong, just so that we present the both sides of the story, he posted a 2,000 word thing on Facebook
recently, waved off the other stuff,
He pretty much admits to the facts on a couple of the more recent ones, he contends that, yes, I did have an intimate relationship with a woman in graduate school. You were right. It was Texas at Austin. Mm. But he says it was a consensual relationship, which we've heard before, as opposed to rape. But I assume both National Geographic and whoever else is carrying the show, I forget for the moment, are investigating this. But this has potential to be a career ender for one of the most popular people in America.
Yeah, well, he's associated with Nova for us on Channel 2. I mean, you know. In some ways, you'd have to say, I think that before all the rest of these people locked on to him, we did in terms of, you know, giving him a platform and exhibiting his talent. And he's very talented. Nobody's going to question that. But you're right. That whole consensual sex thing, I'm thinking about this with regard to Les Moonves now.
Harvey Weinstein saying it was all consensual,
too. I know. But Les Moonves had a woman on call, was to go in and
give him oral sex.
It's, you know, this is... Now, how anybody says to me that that is consensual, I just don't.
That's an employee, by the way,
I'm
we're talking about.
Yeah.
No, I know you do. A CBS employee whose sole function, apparently.
You don't think that was the highlight of her day?
I don't think so. Yeah.
You know, we started, so we don't know where the DeGrasse Tyson thing's going to go. Obviously, we'll keep your prize. You'll be kept the prize. I was saying how
it's what
warm feelings.
By the way. I don't think I've said that.
I feel the same way. I mean, I don't know.
I know.
But I was such
so
a huge admirer of his
too.
Work. I
mean, me too.
God.
Yeah, people look up to him, all these students watching his program.
Well, not only students, every kid who I've ever spoken to, including at GBH, who met him, said how giving and how incredibly warm and willing to talk and share and all these positive things. But if this is all true, it really doesn't matter.
And then at a time when we are, you know, actually questioning scientists with the degree that we are, to find somebody who could demystify. I mean, his book, which was, you know, Don't Be Afraid of, what is the name of something like
know,
something like that,
Don't
Be Afraid of Science, or Breaking It Down for Everybody, was that's important.
And
it's huge. And to lose that is a lot.
You know. So we're talking to Kelly Crossley. I was saying how fond my feelings were for Neil deGrasse Tyson, who I don't know. I also don't know Eric Trump. I have to say I didn't feel that fondly about him. I feel less fondly now. He commented on the relationship between Kellyanne Conway, obviously a key advisor to the president, and her husband George, who is a very called it a dumpster blank show the other day, said he is engaged in witness tampering. We asked CNN's John King about what's really going on in that relationship. Here's what John told us on Tuesday.
My own personal take here is that, you know, someday on Bravo, a year or two from now, we're going to be keeping up with the Conways. I just don't know what else to make. I don't know what else to make of it. And I mean no disrespect to either of them, but it's just the age we live in that it makes absolutely no sense. So therefore, it fits perfectly in the Trump age.
Well, Eric Trump doesn't agree. Eric Trump tweets the following. Of all the ugliness in politics, the disrespect George Conway shows towards his wife, her career, place of work, and everything she has fought so, capital letters S-O, hard to achieve, might top them all. Talking about an issue that is none
of his
business.
Yeah.
It is so but the only downside, when I say none of his business, I was going to say one must assume before he did it, he spoke to Kellyanne Conway, since she was so sympathetic. You're totally right. There's no reason, because it's a Trumpian kind of moment.
Right.
What was your reaction to that?
My reaction was, whoa, you know, this is... You're right in people's bedrooms, and that's not where you want to go, I don't think. I mean, I'm sure everybody's whispering about it. I'm sure it is embarrassing for her inside the White House. But then again, I don't know. Maybe John King is right, and, you know, they're all – the both
keeping
of them go
home.
Keeping
up with the Conways, that's a pretty good
and
line.
And say, this could be a great thing for the two of us. I mean, remember that one of the most vaunted relationships for a long time were – the two, the Republican and the Democrat.
James Carville and Mary Matlin.
Yes. You know, for years and years and years. And, you know, they were on different sides of the political spectrum. It is odd because she is working for the president. And she, for all that we know, has never failed to support him. And if she can't full-on support him, she comes up with something so that she doesn't have to say she doesn't support him. You know, that's been really what her... what she's shown to us. So that says to me that she wants to be there and she wants to have that job. So to have her husband every other day tweeting or writing an op-ed saying this guy's a jerk, he's stupid.
And that,
he's committed crimes.
Criminal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
not just... a criminal.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, we talked to Jennifer Braceras, who is a regular guest And she clerked for the same federal judge that George Conway did.
Oh,
so
really?
She knows him quite well. She was actually at that meeting in Washington that Conway called, I don't know, 3 weeks ago, of conservative lawyers
the
in Washington.
Right?
I don't know if it was through the Federalist Society. Maybe it was.
I could be wrong.
But a conservative lawyer, I thought it was an ad hoc gathering. Basically, conservative lawyers who may agree with Trump's policies, but believe that he is not someone who has honored the letter or the spirit of the law. And you got to give credit. Anybody who's willing to criticize one of their own, whether it's a Democrat or a Democrat or a Republican, I have to say
Because it should be known, George Conway is a very conservative guy.
Oh, yes, he is.
This is not a Carville and whatever situation where they're, you know, somebody's liberal and the other one's not. This guy is really conservative. So,
and she was with Cruz before she went with Trump.
Yeah, so for him to be striking out against, you know, this Donald Trump in a very public way while his wife works for Donald Trump is pretty interesting.
You know, Callie, we're a little short on time, but I didn't want to skip this because we've talked about it with you and others, including a guy who wrote a book on Eric Garner years ago. His mother has been a relentless advocate for justice for her son. We all remember the video and the sound, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe." They appear at least to be having a hearing at this stage of the game. That's it.
Next May. Yes. Now, it's a disciplinary trial that's scheduled for next May. I did not realize that since this happened, which has been four years he's on desk duty, and that the cop is Daniel Pantaleo.
Yeah.
And she's been steadfast. So was his sister, who had since died, died. And it's just amazing to me that the mom has hung in there, even after the city came back and did a financial settlement with her. She said, "This cannot go on for other people. It's not only for me. It's for other New Yorkers. It's for people around the nation. We demand justice, and we haven't gotten that yet."
But this is not a criminal trial.
No.
This is an internal disciplinary.
The decision was made by an administrative judge. Yeah. So, you know, good for her to hang in here, because a lot of people would have said 4 years, lost the daughter. I can't handle this. And she's right, of course. But that's a lot for a mother to hang in.
So what are you doing on Under the Radar?
Under the Radar, we've got pop culture, and one of the big conversations is about Baby, It's Cold Outside, and my people are not seeing how it's a flirty favorite. Aside from the drink part of it, there's also some grabbing lyrics in there as well. So that just, you know, I realized I had never listened to the lyrics.
Nor had I.
You know, I just sort of went and then when you listen to them, you really understand it. So we're talking about that, talking about the feud with Cardi B, talking about Hallmark movies finally getting black people. We're in the world, and they're on the channel, so that's amazing. And the second part of the show, we're looking at the mini representations of the Nutcracker, the reimaginings of the Nutcracker. There's actually five different productions of it, some traditional as you know it and others not, the hip-hop Nutcracker and the urban Nutcracker, and talking about what does that mean, and with both folks from those productions and also a dance historian. Just
that'd be great.
Yeah. So,
Callie Crossley.
Great to see you,
Callie. We're going to see you tonight at 7 o'clock.
We'll be watching.
Yes.
The 20th anniversary of Beat the Press. Callie
Crossley
is host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. She's got her Black Santa on. She wears it every year. Seen that for so many years now. It's great.
I love it.
Yeah.
And her office. That's true.
And her office.
Check it out if you're
coming
by. You
can catch Callie Sunday nights right here on 89.7 at 6 o'clock. You can subscribe to her Under the Radar podcast on iTunes or follow her on Twitter at Callie Crossley. Thanks a lot, Callie. Up next, it is time for our Friday news quiz with a primer on what to get the man in your life this holiday season, or rather, the gentleman in your life. That is next on Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She's Marjorie Egan. We're live at our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. It's time to put on the cufflinks. If I had some, I would. And pull out that decanter of single malt scotch, because we're getting gentlemanly on today's news quiz. And gentle-lately, I guess. Who's better to lead the way than GBH's resident gentleman, Jared Bowen? That'd be the executive arts editor and host of Open Studio. How are you, Jared?
It's so nice of you to say thank you.
I didn't mean it. I read it. And we're also, yes, of course I did. We're joined by Marie Keep. She's with Skinner, where she's the managing director, senior vice president, and director of the Fine Wines and Rare Spirits Department. What brings these two together? And here today is the December Gentleman's Auction, which you can participate on online from December 12th through December 20th. Marie, nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Very nice to meet you.
Great to meet you. So, Marie, what is the Gentleman's Auction, please?
Okay, so twice a year we do the Gentleman's Auction, where we pull objects, fine art, textiles, furniture from all of our departments across the board, whether it's furniture and decorative arts, whether it's books and manuscripts, whiskey, and we put it together in an offering that we hope people will find something that inspires them and think about objects in a different way, see what really resonates with them. And putting it through the lens of a gentleman's auction, you consider things that you put around you in a different way.
So are you wearing fine art? Yeah, I mean, what is that thing you are wearing? That is gorgeous.
It's my version of dressing like a gentleman.
No, but I mean the shirt, too. Is
it
really
beautiful?
Is that something special or just beautiful?
No, it's just a shirt.
It's beautiful. In any case, I want to read something the Gentleman's Auction said about our buddy Jared Bowen, if I may. This edition of the Gentleman's Sale features a generous contribution from WGBH's executive arts editor, Jared Bowen, who is now squirming as I speak. Jared adds a personal touch to the auction by curating a section of objects related to his, quote, likes, Jared, equine activities.
I see where this is going on.
Including fox hunting.
Fox hunting.
Architectural photographs. I'll stop right there. So wait a second. I've known you for a while. I know you partake in equine activities.
Yes.
I knew that for a fact.
Yep.
You do a lot of horseback riding.
I do.
Does that include fox hunting, as they said, or is that not true?
Yes, and I see where you're going with this. I will tell you that I've never seen a fox caught. The fox always outwit the hounds and the horses, and they're really bemused by this in the hunts that I've participated
in.
You've done it.
Yeah.
I'm so impressed.
Well, I grew up riding. You guys know this. I grew up riding, go out to Montana every summer and I ride, and then I have friends on the East Coast with whom I ride, and so I really enjoy
it. You're going to fox hunts like the British. Do you get all dressed up in those outfits?
Yes, it's very serious, the hunt
clubs. Oh, my
gosh. So I just love it, because I love horses. They're just such majestic, beautiful creatures.
So can we get to the fine wine part of this before we start the quiz? Where does this stuff come from? I mean, why do you even have it to auction to begin with?
And Marie's an expert. Knows everything
I know that.
To know
That's why I'm
wines.
Asking, yes. Why is it?
Well, people consign with us for various reasons. They either, their tastes change, palates change as you get older and your experiences change in life. You might have a different size pocketbook, increases or decreases, and you collect in different ways and you decide to sell. And maybe you overcollect. Just like anything else, if you start a collection, you don't realize until you have it all in one place just how much you've gathered. And you decide you're going to pare down and go in a different direction, or just pare down and deaccession.
Okay, let me ask one more stupid question. What are fine prints?
Fine prints. That's a print that has a limited number, and I think Jared was able to come in and find within our paintings and prints department a number of prints which he added into the gentleman's collection.
Yeah, including these beautiful Pinel prints who worked with Whistler and really of that school, and so you see these great depictions of Europe from these etchings. They're very atmospheric. There's one in particular. See, this is the problem with me talking about this.
I
chose a lot of these things, and I want them, but now we're talking about them, so other people will want them as well.
But there's not that many of them. The fine prints, that's what Marie just said, that there's a limited number of them.
Oh, in each edition there's a limited number, but we have a variety too. There's also some great Lichtenstein series that he also signed. It's a triptych that's really fun.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Want to start the quiz, and then we'll ask a few more questions as the quiz goes along, Marjorie?
Okay, we'll start Girl, boy. Yeah, that's right, girl, boy. I'm going to start with you, Jared.
Okay.
Ready?
Yep.
Okay. This week, the mood curdled at a Cheesecake Factory restaurant in Arlington, Virginia, when diners broke out into a fight. What was the cause? A, diners were protesting management's decision to post calorie counts on the menu.
B, one man became enraged when he saw a fellow diner double-dipping in his hot spinach and artichoke dip. Or C, the restaurant offered a free cheesecake promotion to celebrate the chain's 40th anniversary, but had trouble keeping up with the enormous demand.
It was C.
You are correct.
Free cheesecake for everyone.
People
How'd
went
you know that?
Crazy.
Yes. How'd you know that?
Because I was there.
You were there, yeah.
Okay, fine. Now, you know, I'm looking at you, Marie, and I'm saying how far you have fallen from the gentleman's auction to this. It's pathetic, actually. Here's your question anyway. You chose to be here. After years of waiting, Boston is finally getting this type of trendy bar. What kind of bar is it? I actually know the answer to this. A bar. Is that right, judges? Did I pronounce that right?
Thank you.
A bar, where yoga enthusiasts can take classes instead of leaving, say,
Namaste
for drinks after. Thank you. You can tell how much yoga I do. Thank you, Marjorie. An axe-throwing bar where patrons can drink and throw axes at targets. That I can pronounce. And a bar called DNA that makes drinks to appeal to your genetic preferences by analyzing customers' DNA from a strand of hair. Hmm. Would it be yoga, axes, or DNA there, Marie?
Well, although I'm not sure about the mixing of axes and alcohol, I'm going to go with that one.
You are totally... That's a little dangerous. I mean, really.
It is.
Now, before we continue to the second round...
Axe bar?
I heard on the radio this morning.
Yeah, where's it going to be?
Do we know?
Is that our next
Union
Square?
Thank you, Amanda.
Summerville. Thank you. I guess Amanda's heading there this weekend.
That'll be our next mandate, Jim.
Yeah, well, that's right. We haven't done one in months.
We haven't.
Okay, so I have a question for you, Jared. I was reading a Mark Shanahan piece on Marie, and a term came up that Marjorie and I, we discuss this issue, would you agree, almost every single day? We discuss ullage almost every morning when
ullage.
We get to work.
Do you?
No. So why don't you tell us what ullage is there, Jared Bone? Go ahead. What is
now,
it?
Now, see, you've just thrown me under the bus, and I can't tell you what that
okay,
is,
okay, I can tell you what it is. Tell me if I'm right, okay. Marie. I never even heard the word till this morning.
Okay.
It is the distance between the top of the cork and the top of the bottle. Is that correct?
That's very good.
Very good.
No, what do you mean top of the bottle?
The bottle top, right? No? Mm. Oh, I was so close.
Oh,
you okay, were halfway. You were halfway there.
Okay, what's the other half I got wrong?
Okay, so you go from the bottom of the cork to the top of the wine that's in the bottle. It's the headspace.
Oh, ullage.
And why is that a significant thing?
Because over time there is evaporation and transfer through the cork, and if you have too much, the ullage goes down too far. There's too much of a rapid oxygen transfer, and the wine ages in a more rapid rate than you would want.
Of course it does.
Okay, now, so for people that
but a certain amount of ullage is what you would expect.
Oh, ullage. I got it wrong?
Well, there's a debate. It's fine. You've said
you're
it.
Trying
just,
to be,
you said
you're trying
it
to be nice
fine.
To me because you feel bad just for fine. Me? Yeah, it's obviously ullage.
But, you know, if you are drinking a fine wine, mm-hmm. you probably... You better drink the whole bottle because there's no way to preserve it. Is that correct?
Well, if you're drinking a fine wine, you really want to drink the whole bottle.
Excuse me. I don't mean to interrupt our guests. Only Marjorie. We're on live. You know, this is live radio.
This is live.
As we are talking to Marjorie, she is emptying a pill bottle into her hand. Well, what are you taking?
I'm not feeling well today.
So what are you taking?
I'm taking ibuprofen. Yes.
Oh, my God.
I'm not feeling well.
In any case, by the way, here's the deal. If anybody on Monday, we're not going to mention this Monday, during the 3 hours, 11 to 2, uses the term ullage in a sentence on our air, you will get a free WGBH mug. Is that a deal, Marjorie?
Absolutely, Jim. Whatever you say.
Ullage. Okay, round number two, please.
Here we go, Jared. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, launched a campaign this week to stop anti-animal phrases, which they compared to racism, homophobia, and other discriminatory language. One of these is a real suggestion on PETA's list. Which one? A, instead of saying, kill two birds with one stone, they want you to say, feed two birds with one scone. Instead of saying, flip the bird, they want you to say, flip the cheese curd. And instead of saying, take the bull by the horns, they want you to say, take the bull to see Hamilton on Broadway.
Well, I think it's not
C. We're not done yet.
There's two more. Oh,
yes.
There's two more. I didn't
Keep
see
going.
Those.
Thank you.
They like to play along, so I cover up the answer.
Okay.
D is instead of saying, bring home the bacon, say, bring home Liam Neeson's daughter from Taken. Or E, instead of saying, his goose is cooked, say, call your mother once in a while. Why don't you ever call her? She loves you and misses you. So do you know which one it is? That's a lot.
I hope there wasn't a message, a hidden message in there for me.
Yeah,
Marjorie.
Your mother called us earlier and asked us to put that question in there.
I think, especially if it's a newsfeed cafe scone, it might be a.
You are correct. Wow. Very good.
Impressive.
Very good. That's a good one.
By the way, for those who are not at the studio at the public library, Marjorie is now applying Vicks VapoRub to her chest.
And you have the foot massager going on, Marjorie.
I do. I'm falling apart, Jared.
Okay, Marie, you're behind 2-1. Okay. Here's your chance to tie it up before the bonus round.
Okay.
In the Netherlands, a man gave new meaning to the phrase born again when he asked, when he asked the judge to alter government-issued documents to say what, saying it's no different than changing one's gender. A, identify his birthplace as Israel despite being born in Amsterdam. B, have his legal birthday changed to say he's 20 years younger than he actually is. Or C, have his birth certificate and social insurance changed to identify Stanford University, where he attended college, as his parents, because this is where he felt he discovered his true self. Was it A, his birthplace, B, his age or birth date, or C, whatever that was about Stanford University? A, B, or C, please. This is a chance to tie it up into the before we go to the bonus round.
I think you're trying to make C sound really good with all the words, but I'm going to choose B.
Ding, ding, ding. It's
wow.
2-2. So before we go to the bonus round, this whole auction thing is online? Is that what
it
the deal is?
It is all online.
And, and people are doing live? What do you do exactly in this
So I already did my work.
Oh, you did? What did you do?
His work
so
is
they,
done.
They called me up and asked if I would essentially be this guest curator. And so I had, so they asked me what some of my interests are. Horses, I like bourbon.
Fox hunting.
And just things. I mean, this is part of what I really like about auctions and Skinner. Is that we're such a society that has to have everything new. And, I mean, sometimes I walk down the street and I think, wow, look at all these houses. They're just filled with stuff. And I think it's so nice to be able to look at things that other people have had, other people have treasured, mm-hmm. and then bring them into your own home and live with them and assign them stories. There are a couple of things I didn't really know what they were, mm-hmm. but I love them. One looked like it came from a parlor out of Sherlock Holmes or something. Mm-hmm. I think it's the cordial set. So I went out to Marlborough, where their warehouse mm-hmm. is, and I walked through and just had the opportunity to pick things I liked and have them included in the auction.
That's actually great.
It was
that
so
great.
Much fun. I had
Sounds
a blast.
Like huge
so
fun.
Is this, I presume, can be a wonderful Christmas gift?
Well, yes. It would be a perfect Christmas gift. And there are things in there that I look at that I think this would be a perfect Christmas gift for me or a woman in my life. So I think when we're putting things in the gentleman's auction, it's just a way of really having people consider it. You know, there's the historical idea of gentlemen based upon class, wealth, power. There's the modern-day gentleman. And I think everyone can drop into that idea of a modern-day gentleman and dip back out. But there's so many really whimsical, beautiful, historically relevant things that are in this auction.
Actually, but I don't want to be critical of what you're saying, Marie, but let's be honest.
Okay, Jim.
If the ullage is not right, then everything, would you not agree that everything falls apart?
That's
would you
key.
Not?
It's
okay,
key.
Well, then we're fine on that. What do you want to say there,
Jared? I was just going to say, I mean, to give you a sense of how wide it goes, one of my favorite things is this poster from World War II that advised people to be able to identify aircraft. I think it was a British poster.
Oh, that is a great poster.
To identify enemy aircraft, which I just thought was so fascinating, and it took you to what it must have been like to live in that time, that they had to disseminate these kinds of posters.
Okay, so here's the deal. In honor of our guests, this is a bonus round. From the gentleman's auction, we'll test their knowledge of the consummate gentleman. That would be the most interesting man in the world. Now, this question you asked
we'll
first
go, girl,
of Marie.
Girl.
Yes,
so here we go, Marie. Question one. Beer company Dos Equis rolled out their iconic Most Interesting Man in the World ad campaign starring actor Jonathan Goldsmith in 2006. But did you know there is a WGBH connection?
I didn't.
Which WGBH personality provided the voiceover? Was it frontline narrator Will Lyman? Was it a Celtic Sojourn host Brian O'Donovan? Was it the most interesting man in the SNS deli? That would be, of course, Jim Browdy.
Is it A, B, or C?
Can you give me a hint?
No. you're
standing in front of me. I'm going to say it's you.
Ding, ding. No, man, that was pathetic,
I'm
going
to go B.
You don't get to do twice. Well, actually, you do because you're wrong two times.
I'm going to guess A.
Yes, you are correct. It is indeed frontline narrator Will Lyman who's got
arguably the greatest narrator in the history of that right television. Yeah. Okay, now you can, whatever it is, go ahead here. You ready for this, Jared there?
I am ready.
Okay, the fox hunting Jared Bowen. And how'd you like his defense of fox hunting? Because he was obviously a little embarrassed. Is that he never caught any fox, but your attempt was to go get a fox, was it not?
It's more about riding to the woods, is what
sure
it's all
it is.
About.
Okay, fine. The ads chronicle, this is question two. The ads chronicle the most interesting man's fantastic adventures and characteristics. Which of the following is not one of them, Jared? You paying attention?
I'm looking at you.
Okay,
aren't
fine.
I?
A, he is his own chief of staff. B, sharks have a week dedicated to him. Or C, he found the fountain of youth but didn't drink from it because he wasn't thirsty. Which is not one of them, A, B, or C?
Which is not one of them?
Uh-huh.
Turns out I wasn't paying attention, actually.
Chief of state.
I'm going to guess B.
That's wrong. Now, you, if you guess this right here, you can tie this whole baby up here, Marie.
Okay.
What is it?
What was A?
Chief of staff or the fountain of youth?
Fountain of youth.
No, say chief of staff.
Chief of staff.
Chief of staff is correct. That's right. And it is tie going into the final question. Marjorie, this is really exciting.
We are taking no
I like how you're scoring.
No, it's
here we
good.
Go. Here we go, Jared. Question three. In 2012, SNL spoofed the character with a skit centered around whom? A, a take on the shape of water, the most interesting merman in the world. B, the most interesting man in the world's beleaguered supervisor. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Or C, the most interesting man in the world's unimpressive son.
This is for all the marbles because it's tied.
This is for Saturday Night Live.
So take your time. Yeah, this is pretty important.
Okay, I don't think it's A, so I will go with B.
Oh man!
Oops.
Now, if you guess this, you can win. I know that means a lot to you, Marie.
It
so
does.
Is it A or C? And don't ask me what they are again. Just that guess, and let's get this over with,
C.
Okay?
C.
That is right.
You are correct.
It's
very
unbelievable.
Good.
Congratulations. How's that feel,
you.
By the way?
Really satisfying.
Feels really good.
It's really satisfying.
It's good for us, too.
Okay.
So you have a minute. Give us one more pitch on
all
this
right,
gentleman's
so,
auction thing.
The gentleman's auction is online from the 12th to the 20th. You can come and preview it live on the 12th and the 13th in the Boston Gallery. And go online. You get to see snippets of video of Jared looking at the material and speaking about what really resonated with him. Take a look, scroll through, and I guarantee everyone will find something they love.
You know, last year I gave you the Salami of the Month.
One of the best. One of the best ever.
Maybe
gifts.
This year it's something from the gentleman's auction.
Well,
Jim.
You could give him the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel car hood ornament.
Oh,
very!
That
good.
Is something I have wanted. Actually,
it was fashioned after one specific dog that won a very important title 3 years in a row.
Really?
There's a very cool Art Deco champagne bucket, Marjorie. You might buy that for Jim.
Oh. Love it,
Champagne Delbec.
Thank you.
I think of Jim as a gentleman every time I look at him.
Exactly.
In his ripped jeans over there.
Marie, it's great to meet you.
It's
Jared,
to
it's
you.
Great to see
Jim.
You.
The gentleman's
course.
Auction Thanks online, December 12th to the 20th. To learn more about Skinner Inc. .com. To learn more about it, go to skinnerinc.com.
Is that the right site? I want to make sure we got it right.
Skinnerinc.com.
Yep. Thanks. Great.
Okay.
Good.
Jared Bowen is WGBH Executive Arts Editor
she
and
is.
Fox
he
Hunter
is.
And the host of Open Studio, which you can catch Friday nights right here, 8:30 on WGBH2. Marie Keep is the Managing Director, Senior Vice President, and Founder and Director of the Fine Wines and Rare Spirits Departments at Skinner. Marie and Jared, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marjorie,
for coming in. And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Thank you to everybody that came down to the Boston
thank
Public
you very
Library.
Much.
We really appreciate that. Tune in Monday for our Politics Roundup. Charlie Sennett on the latest global headlines. And the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price are all revved up, and they'll be on all revved up. Emily Rooney's 20th anniversary is tonight. Beat the Press, 7 o'clock. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Arjun Singh. Our engineer is John McClaw Parker, and our on-site engineer is Miles Smith. Special thanks to the gang over at the Newsfeed Cafe. Do you have anything you'd like to add, Jim?
Well, we only have 10 seconds. Didn't you start on Beat the Press as an intern? Was that one of your first deals?
Greater Boston and Beat the Press, yes.
That's pretty exciting. It's a big night.
Yeah.
20th anniversary live. I'm really excited about the show. Watch it, and we'll catch you again Monday morning.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again on Monday, and have a great weekend.